Okay, great. So next we move on to Rob for uterine rupture.
Well, my component's uterine rupture, and I'm not exactly sure how I feel about this, so let me just sort of summarize. It's a very rare event. It occurs in about 0.06% to 0.55% of the general population. It occurs in a greater frequency for VBACs at about 1.5%. The developers feel that uterine rupture could be associated with substandard care, being especially reflective of management decisions during labor, induction of labor, or augmentation of labor. And they feel that the rate of rupture is an indirect measure of clinical decision-making. ACOG rates this third out of the 10 measures on their waiting list. I had some concerns originally about the feasibility and maybe confusion of data collection between a true uterine rupture and a dehiscence, which we see quite frequently, but I think they'll work that out. So it's something that happens very, very rarely. You know, it can happen in spontaneous labors as well, which would not be any kind of substandard care necessarily. And it could be prevented by a C-section.
Thank you. Comments on uterine rupture as a component of this measure?
So I think this is one of those that this could drive us exactly where we don't want to go. I mean, I feel like this is one measure where you put this out to the public and, well, not even the public, I'm thinking myself, okay, if I'm going to get dinged for a uterine rupture because I allowed someone to labor because that's what she wanted and I had everything in my institution to support that, it's not going to be that long before I get smart and say, you know what, there's no benefit to this hospital to do VBACs, and we'll be done. So if we want to close that door, which I understand there's a lot of people who want to close that door and make that access, then I really think that putting this out will get us, we're getting there anyway, but I really feel strongly that this will probably close the door on it.
Just really briefly to that, I agree with the logic of that, but when he said it, I thought, okay, the cesarean you want to prevent is the primary one, and that way you don't have uterine ruptures. I mean, that's a good way to prevent uterine ruptures, is not to do the primary.
That makes great sense, but the reality is that, and we're working on that, we have a measure. So, but the reality is that this will also take away any patient who feels that she wants to give it a go. It's not even, she's not going to have any access.
And 20% of childbearing pregnant women now have a history of cesarean.
And I think furthermore, from a quality standpoint, this is a rare event, and each one of these would be scrutinized at the quality committee at the local hospital. So it's not like these things are going to happen just and no one's ever going to pay any attention. They'll be looked at, and if there has been misuse of Pitocin or a mismanagement of labor, that would be addressed at that local level.
Other comments about uterine rupture as a component?
Probably just speak to why would it be before maternal admission to the ICU? It seems like uterine rupture is weighted too much. Can we speak to the weighting? And it seems like it's too heavily weighted because of some of these issues. And often it's not avoidable. If you want to let someone do a VBAC, you may have a uterine rupture. And when we discuss that with patients, that's somewhat predictable as an outcome with VBAC. So I think it's weighted too heavily.
So we could go on record as saying that, but we can't negotiate to change the terms of what we're considering. Are we ready to vote? 37 seconds, you're good. Vote. So on that, we have 4 yes and 20 no. And I think we didn't report to the people on the phone. The first measure was evenly divided, 12 and 12. So now we're going to go to Elizabeth for unplanned maternal ICU admission.
Okay, so this isn't my area of expertise, but I'm going to do both this one and the NICU admissions. And I do develop outcomes measures for a living, and I just wanted to, in 30 seconds, comment on this as an outcomes measure going to NQF. It isn't risk-adjusted. We've talked about why. If you think 50% are preventable and 50% are not, it's really hard to understand why the measure is not risk-adjusted. There's a requirement in NQF, if you're not going to risk-adjust an outcome, that you show that risk adjustment is not needed. And there is no data in the application that I saw anywhere where risk adjustment, for example, for patient factors like age even were tested and dismissed. So that's a huge thing. And then another thing is that usually for outcomes measures, we try to characterize the amount of uncertainty around our estimates because outcomes are affected by quality and by chance and by patient factors, and we like to try to at least capture the quantify the chance, the amount of variation that's probably due to chance, so that we're comparing providers fairly and not by chance calling some providers worse than others. So that's just as a preface. And then finally, when we're moving from a QI measure, and it sounds like there's a lot of experience with this as a constructive QI measure towards a measure for comparing, then we have to pay attention to how the outcomes are defined and whether those outcomes are coded, as we talked about a lot in this group, I think, in the last 2 days, systematically across institutions. So I'm going to be speaking to that as I look at this measure and then the NICU admission measure. And so briefly, this component is unplanned maternal admission to the ICU, which has a frequency, is reported here, of 0.1 to 0.4% of deliveries, and the rationale that the causes are typically preventable, including hemorrhage, sepsis, hypertension, pulmonary edema. The numerator, one thing I think Reba encouraged me to look at since I was looking at two of these last night, was how specifically the numerator and denominator are defined for these components of the outcome, and they are specified as DRGs or MSDRGs, and the data source is multiple potential data sources, so you could use claims, medical records, et cetera, and the DRGs and MSDRGs are deliveries, essentially, either vaginal or C-section, but there's also an OR statement, and I wasn't sure I could follow it completely, that identified women who were treated with ventilatory support, I think in a positive way defined to include not just intubation, but positive pressure, et cetera, and so I think that the NICU stay component of this may be NICU or, and I just need to clarify with you all, NICU or use of respiratory support. And I don't know if that's true or it's just admission to a NICU, so maybe you can quickly clarify. I mean, sorry, I'm NICU on the brain. ICU, sorry.
No, I think it's an OR statement because some of the hospitals you can get at the unplanned admission through billing data, and with the exceptions that it has to be a postpartum complication. But if the hospital does not have per se an ICU or they do not code ICU charges, the clinical conditions were added to capture those women that may be in some other defined area but have a very serious unplanned complication.
So I couldn't totally follow that. I'm going to sum up and then I can speak to the overall thing because there's also in 2A1.8, there's under denominator details, there's an allowed exclusion for planned ICU admissions for things like placenta accreta is given as an example. And yet it says under 2B3.1, which restricts to validity, that the planned postpartum admissions to the ICU can be excluded but must be identified by chart review. So I think there's some, to me, I wasn't completely able to discern from the written specifications what is allowed and not allowed to try to pull out planned admissions. I think it's always good in an outcome measure try to pull out planned procedures, which are not, those are by definition not things where, or planned outcomes. These are not, in this case, an admission to an ICU. Those are not things we're trying to measure or prevent, but it wasn't clear that the mechanism is really well defined here to do that, or that medically we could anticipate clearly, and I just don't know enough about OB, what was planned or unplanned and differentiate. So why don't I sum up, and then you guys, if you want to speak, because I know I'm running out of time. So I just, in summary, these are ICU admissions, ICU days, but it sounds like in hospitals without ICUs, ICU-type care would be captured. The rate is pretty low in this population, 0.1 to 0.4%. You're trying to develop a mechanism to pull out unplanned, pull planned out and only capture unplanned. But for me, the overwhelming, so there's a concern for me about the uniformity of that outcome, whether someone is admitted to, or not to the ICU, given the way the measures specify. Have you, are we really saying ICU admission at the IDMC is the same as an ICU admission at local community hospital? Is it really the same group of patients that you're, the same outcome that you're capturing there? And I think given our discussion about NICUs and the variation in how they're defined there, I don't know as much about adult ICUs, but I would be concerned that that outcome would be capturing very different things across hospitals. And then just overall, the measure's not risk adjusted, and I assume that maternal factors affect risk of ICU admission.
Did you want to comment on that?
Sure. I think in terms of the definition of the patients, if you have coded data, you can look at antepartum conditions and in the ICU admission, which is an appropriate admission to an ICU, versus a postpartum complication. So that's part of the distinction, is to look at the fifth digit for the ICD-9 codes to indicate that this is a postpartum complication within the range of OB complications. The other issue is if the hospital does not have an adult ICU or does not code their financial data that way, charge for that activity, that you have to get at the other level of complications using the ICD-9 codes or procedures, the procedures for intubation, et cetera, et cetera. The other issue is if a hospital does not have the capability to put the woman in an ICU and needs to transfer that woman out immediately. That's where you get into the transfer issue, both on the neonatal side and on the adult side, that the woman or the baby is transferred out immediately, and on the adult side has a postpartum complication. So the assumption, it's not perfect, but the assumption is that they're going out because that hospital cannot accommodate that woman.
Yeah, I apologize. I forgot to define. I didn't define the numerator because I expect to say it's admission to the ICU or transfer to another hospital for ICU admission. So
I'll just comment quickly on the issue of trying to deal with a plan. You've already heard that in theory this should be a postpartum event. We can, Janet can get that from the fifth digit. We looked very long and hard at whether there were any conditions that might have a high enough planned ICU rate that we would say, let's exclude those. And the fact is there are very few of those. And we couldn't come up, mom comes in with an uncorrected TET and happens to be pregnant, probably a good idea to put her into an intensive care unit around the time of her delivery. Extraordinarily rare cause of an intensive care unit admission. So there weren't any that were, it's true, for CREDA, many of them are going to go, but not all of them, and not even maybe many of them. And so the ability to sort of identify that through coding was pretty tough, or to exclude specific pre-existing conditions was actually, we did not think we could do.
Thank you. Other members of the committee?
So I think that this is one of those areas where, as you alluded to, comparing ICU definitions would be difficult because, I think, I'm at Mass General and I can watch things on the labor floor because I have awesome anesthesiologists looking over my shoulder for a lot longer than necessarily somebody might do at another hospital. And I sort of feel like, another bad care would be
keeping them on your unit too long and not going to the ICU and sort of not recognizing that you've got someone who's in shock, which I think we hear all the time. So I don't know how to sort of grapple with that. I sort of recognize the benefit of looking at ICU admissions, but I just wonder about sort of another area where the risk stratification or somehow separating these hospitals, you know, I'm sure that, you know, on Jennifer's unit, she can hold on to things a long time too, and even tertiary care centers though are vastly different.
We certainly can do the risk, the stratification, and that's already been done, and we could do this by, you know, number of deliveries. We don't have the data on things like 24/7 OB anesthesia trained anesthesiologists,
right?
So that would be more difficult. Although in theory, one could stratify for that if one had those data. The issue of, and this gets to the previous question of whether people are actually going to keep people out of the ICU in order to avoid this numerator. None of us were having such a hard time believing it. Although you also commented on the idea that not going to the failure to recognize that this patient, where it's not an on-purpose decision. You're not saying, oh, I don't want to take that hit, but they just aren't realizing it. Those folks are going to end up in the ICU or dead or one of these other events anyway, right? I mean, if they're that sick, they're going to get there one way or another. So I'm not worried very much about missing those folks.
Other urgent comments? Yes, Kim.
So I just, first of all, hi, Susie, man.
I guess that it goes back to the tenor of the purpose, and that is that it represents bad care. And I agree that it's important to do case finding for patients going to the ICU in the same way that we're looking at maternal events for maternal deaths as sentinel events, and the possibility to review systems of care that could be improved. But I would argue that, you know, I would argue, especially after reviewing some of the maternal deaths in California, that the majority of patients who ended up in the ICU, it was actually a good thing that they were there. And I just sort of, I'm concerned that we're sending the wrong message.
There's no question that in general going to the intensive care unit is the right thing to do, right? But the fact is most of the diagnoses that lead to this are associated with bad care, and therefore potentially that ICU could have been not a part of the, let me back up.
I mean,
up
I would say,
this.
For example, preeclampsia is probably one of the leading causes.
It is.
And that's not preventable. We have yet to be able to prevent it.
Not preeclampsia, but the ICU admission might be.
The health, I mean, most of them are going because of health. Or some PTP variant or some variation thereof.
Some of those ones you're not going to prevent. The hypertensive crisis, you might.
Well, yeah.
Right? The bleed because of the hypertensive crisis, you might. There are lots of, and there's very compelling data that's demonstrating that blood pressure control is done poorly in the severe preeclampsia a very large percent of the time. Now, when I say there's often substandard care, let me quantify. I'm saying on the order of 50% of these cases. So you're absolutely right. And we've talked about this over. And this is the problem, going to be your problem with outcome measures forever. Right. That all of them that I've ever looked at, they've got about a 50% preventability rate. And many, many, many of those are not able to be risk adjusted at this point or identified which ones are in fact preventable. And you all are going to have to deal with it over and over again, whether that's good enough to help you want to measure it.
So, comment, please, and then
okay.
We need to take a vote.
Thanks. I actually, what's great about outcomes measures, from my standpoint, is you don't have to know which ones are preventable. You don't. You have to risk adjust out the patient factors. You have to account for chance variation. And then you can compare how hospitals do on them, and some are going to do better than others. And if there's a lot of variation, then we know some are preventable.
And in fact, when we think about outcomes measures, we try and we don't, in my group, we don't like, you know, to try to find the preventable thing in particular. You do want to find something you can affect, but the concept isn't, okay, you can prevent this and get it down to zero. It's can you lower the risk environment the patient is in and lower the rate so that the worst performers start to look more like the best performers. So I don't think it's an issue that whether something's preventable, you know, identifying any individual patient whether something's preventable or not. Planned is a different concept, and you know, it would be wonderful if we could always tell what was planned and what was not, but the data doesn't support it always.
Okay, let's take okay.
This is a process, not an outcome. ICU admission is a process. It's not a patient outcome.
Yeah, I think it's on the border. I don't know. It's some intermediate, it's a signal. It's not a process in the sense that it's clinically, you know, it's the standard of care, like giving an aspirin at arrival for MRI. It's not that kind of a process measure, but it's an intermediate outcome, I think, is what we would call it. It's not necessarily something that's bad for the patient, but it's maybe on the pathway to something then.
Okay, can we take a vote, please, on unplanned ICU admission of mothers? Okay, so we have 8 yes and 16 no, and we'll move on to Mary for third and fourth degree lacerations.
Okay. All right, so third and fourth degree lacerations, this is not a previously endorsed measure. The numerator is the number of women who suffer a third or fourth degree laceration of the perineum during vaginal delivery. The denominator is all women who deliver, not all women who deliver vaginally, but all women who deliver. With regard to having a high impact, it is a national priority partnership goal, so it meets that criteria via that mechanism. Happens in as high as 30% of operational vaginal deliveries, and in 2009 that was 3.7% of the births in this country. In terms of there being a gap, there's several OB management modes such as episiotomy and operal vaginal delivery that can be modified that would affect the number of third and fourth degree chairs. And there's some patient risk factors that theoretically could be modified, so it is something that we could have an impact on. A lot of the evidence presented in the forum was really about the AOI and not so much about third and fourth degrees chair, but there's, I would say, a moderate amount of evidence. In terms of reliability testing at Beth Israel, they commented that there was a strong match in terms of their reliability testing, but they also commented that when there was not a strong match, and they described what that they did about it, so it suggested that maybe there was some problems in terms of the match during the reliability testing. And I think one of the things with third and fourth degree chairs is that it's been documented in several studies that there's a lot of variation between provider diagnosis and also coding. There's problems with coding, and it's mentioned even in the forum that a second degree tear with an extension is coded as a third degree tear, and a third degree tear with an extension is coded as a fourth degree tear, and there's some variability in how it's coded. So reliability might be not as good as it could be. Validity testing based on what's said in the form, I think, is high. And it has been used for public reporting, both by JCO and by ARC. And I think it appears to be easily collectible data. So I'll open it up.
I wish Bill Grumman was here, but he's got a beautiful study from 2006 in the Gray Journal that talks about why this measure has to be risk-adjusted and is not a great quality measure. I'm sorry if you're free to communicate that paper.
Comments from any? Kathleen?
Well, I just wanted to mention that the Joint Commission decided not that that measure was retired, so it's not something that's ongoing. That was retired in the first sentence, and then the incidence of the episiotomy was decided would be a better thing than the third and fourth degree. That's not current.
What's substandard about getting a third degree midline laceration on a vaginal delivery of a 9-pound baby? What's substandard about that?
Let the obstetricians speak to that. So, Susan.
Was this for the average outcome is a created, it was at a time when both Joint Commission and AHRQ were collecting this data, and it was felt that obviously it was important to bodies higher up than the consensus panel, and it was felt that it needs to be included. And that was the thinking then, and because the literature has been, or measurement has been done historically with it, it has remained in the average outcome there.
But that's now been retired, and we're just looking at episiotomy rates. So the emphasis has changed.
Well, to ask you a question, probably nothing, although, again, I'm an anesthesiologist. The question, though, is why are we looking at episiotomy rates? Well, why are you all looking at episiotomy rates? And my assumption is because it's associated with an increased risk for third and fourth degree tears. What's that? You're right. But so what we're getting at is, if you do an episiotomy and nothing bad happens, and the provider gets dinged, and it speaks to now, are we looking at measures that are process measures? And as a provider, I love that because I can give my antibiotics within 60 minutes of incision, and I've done a good job, and our hospital looks great on our skip measures, and off we go. But if the patient gets a wound infection, despite that, the patient doesn't care how well I did. The patient got a wound infection. And if we look at care from the patient's standpoint rather than from the provider's standpoint, they don't care whether or not you cut an episiotomy. They care whether or not they got a fourth degree tear and now have fecal incontinence for the rest of their life, right? That's what they care about. And so that's why the outcome. Now, it is true that we've kept this largely for historic reasons, and we've thought about it over and over again, and it's entirely possible that we'll end up retiring out as well. But still, philosophically, you all are saying, let's change this so that we measure what the clinicians are doing, and I'm saying, I care more about the mom's perineum than the decisions made by the clinicians.
But I think the point is...
The bonus of the episiotomy would not be a third and fourth degree. When it's coded as an extension to the third or fourth degree.
Nancy, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess we have to remember, though, that for a huge 2-3 generations of women, they regularly had their perineums incised. And I can tell you, it was not pleasant. And I can also tell you that when you had an extension of one of those, it was not pleasant. And what we do know from the literature and from the data is that the episiotomy is the precursor to the third or the fourth degree extension. That's so clear that that's the precursor event. And so that's why we've already adopted that as a measure. And so to look at simply third and fourth degrees does not get at the sentinel event, if we want to use that terminology, which is the episiotomy itself. And once you've done that, like someone said, I don't know if it was Laura that said this, someone said, if it's a difficult delivery because it's a large fetus
and we've done the episiotomy, we've already set up the situation in which the woman is likely to have her third or fourth degree lapse. So, you know, I don't buy your logic that the episiotomy is not the appropriate thing to measure, which is very easy to measure off the chart. So, anyway.
From a measurement standpoint, you're absolutely right, it's easier. And we're in agreement that the way that the third and fourth degree tears would be influenced is by creating practice improvements around episiotomy, right? Also probably around the operative vaginal deliveries. The OB anesthesia literature demonstrates that there are many obstetricians who do operative vaginal deliveries because mom's got an epidural in, not because she necessarily needs it, but because she happens to have one in, or this is the one they teach the resident on because she's got one in. I mean, so there are lots of places in both of those where there could be quality improvement efforts to decrease the rate of this outcome. As I said, it's a question of whether you want to get up at measuring the risks at the process level or the actual outcome, and that's somewhat philosophical.
So, Kathleen, and then we'll have a vote.
I just wanted to mention that if you did go from episiotomy to, I mean, from third and fourth degree to episiotomy, right now, third and fourth degree laceration already drives this measure when, you know, it's the most common thing, my understanding. So if you went to episiotomy, then the whole thing would be, AOI would be about episiotomies because then you would have a higher number of those rather than, you know, it would totally screw up the whole thing. So, I mean, that's all it would be about with episiotomies. And I agree with you that the episiotomy is the bad event, but I'm just, you know, from the purpose, what they're trying to do is that would be pretty much it. Then it would all be about.
I was objecting to the idea that women don't care if they have an episiotomy.
Oh yeah,
that's what was said.
Given my gender, I will do better about trying to presume what women do and do not care about. But fair enough.
Thank you. Let's take a vote. Okay, so we have 7 yes and 17 no. Now, we've just made an executive decision that the way we're going to pick up some time here is to have a working lunch. So I'm going to ask you if sandwiches, easy to do, five of to be back, okay? So don't get sidetracked with conversations, et cetera, phone. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move ahead with Lee on unintended operative procedure.
This component addresses so-called unintended operative procedures. This is the numerator is the number of women who during their delivery hospitalization, which for me turned out to be important, have an unanticipated operative procedure with basically D&Cs or repair control of hemorrhage. There are a few more codes in there, but that's sort of the broad categories. The question that I had as I read this through was, and again, an awful lot of the material that was submitted related to the whole AOI and not necessarily specifically to this component. The fact that you're tracking this only during the actual admission for the delivery suggests to me that you might miss a significant number of cases in which there was somehow the case was not handled as well as it might have been, and the woman has gone home, and then the hemorrhage develops, or the need for the D&C, or et cetera. So I was just curious about whether or not you all felt comfortable that this was adequate as a measure of what were perhaps inappropriate care.
Yeah.
Dr. Mann? Just maybe.
If you're on mute, we can't hear you.
I can speak to that a little bit. But the issue, of course, there is the capture of those who have gone home. We could, of course, capture them if they came back to the admitting hospital, but if they went somewhere else, we would be unable completely to identify those folks. And that's why this decision was made primarily.
As I read the description, even if they returned, if it wasn't within the original hospitalization, it wouldn't be in your enumerator. Am I wrong?
Correct. The reason to exclude those is you end up, you know, now speaking to very different practice areas. You know, I'm in Boston. You throw a stone, you hit four hospitals. Right? Whereas if you're someplace that has only one hospital for 100 miles, they are going to get all of those returns, and I'm likely to get none. And so it wasn't reasonable to have those come back and count in the numerator when that practice patterns would be so different from one location to another.
In essence, the damage could have been created at Hospital B, and the person was admitted to Hospital B for the correction.
Right.
Okay.
Other comments? So a downside of that strategy, because I think that's a good example of where you thought about differences in systems in defining the outcome. But the downside is that hospitals with shorter lengths of stay will send their patients home earlier, which may put them at risk for some for the outcome. They're going to get off the hook by doing that or be held less accountable.
Well, I would probably also add that sometimes it's not the hospital that determines whether you stay a short time. It's the patient, him or herself in this instance.
Other comments on unanticipated operative procedure? Okay, so let's take a vote then. Okay, so we have 15 yes and 9 no.
You're just happier now that you have food.
Okay.
I'll just read it out.
Okay.
Do it. It's not a
so problem. Sarah Brown's not here.
The next one is measure 750, which is maternal blood transfusion, and we do have the DRG and MS-DRG codes for blood transfusion, again, as part of the component. I think there's been some conversation earlier about, you know, appropriateness of blood transfusion at times. But I think blood transfusion in and of itself is fairly straightforward.
Any comments about maternal blood transfusion as a component of this composite measure? Okay, so let's vote.
Sorry, I wasn't worried.
So we have 17 yes and 7 no on that one. And we're turning to 5-minute APGAR, less than 7, and Jaleel.
So I had difficulty navigating through the submitted document. Partly it's because it does not address the specific
component. Could you speak a little closer to me?
I have my place up here. So I had difficulty navigating through the submitted document, partly it's because it does not specifically address the specific component. It addresses the general measure. And partly it is because the questions are not specifically answered in multiple places and things like that. So anyway, the measure is 5 minute APGAR of less than 7. And my thought is that is a low APGAR score a measure of substandard care or a preventable complication? So that's the issue over here. So one of the references that has been mentioned is the citation for evidence of high impact is the policy statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Actually, when you read the AAP statement, it actually focuses on being more cautious about the use of APGAR score because a number of factors may influence the APGAR score. It is inappropriate to use APGAR score alone to establish the diagnosis of asphyxia because there are so many other components. Maybe a better measure would be checking your cord blood gas for fetal acidemia. So that would probably be more appropriate. And an APGAR score at 5 minutes in term infants correlates poorly if you're looking at the neonatal outcomes. It correlates poorly with the neurological outcome. So that doesn't help either. And can it be used for monitoring the delivery service? Yes, it does say that it can be useful, but with a caveat, it says specifically in that document that individual case reviews are more can identify these issues, and it doesn't. It probably doesn't help as a quality measure disclosure.
Public reporting?
Yeah, public reporting. That was the word I was looking for. So I'm not sure whether this is a good measure or not because there are multiple factors which do factor in. And one of the citations for data on the performance gap that they have mentioned are three citations which specifically, again, do not address APGAR score but address the index as such. So it doesn't help in that. And then there's one more citation which looks at a Swedish registry and looking at low APGAR score of five minutes. And I went back and looked at that article, and it's a Swedish registry, and what weighs in more is the birth weight and the gestation. And there are several obstetric risk factors which are associated with a low 5 minute APGAR score in term infants, but many of them are pre-eclampsia and things like that which we don't have control on. So I'm not sure whether it helps either. So maybe as a composite measure it might help, but individually is this outcome measure an important one which can be reported publicly? I don't think so.
Just quickly, we do restrict this to term babies at 2,500 grams, so we're dealing with much of the prematurity issue. And yes, there are many, as is true with all of these, there are many factors that can influence it, but that certainly does include obstetric management and obstetric decisions. We also exclude many congenital anomalies to try to look at basically healthy term babies who now come out with a pretty low APGAR score that is maintained. It's not just a baby that you know has a vacuum or assisted delivery and comes out in the gold sun and by 5 minutes it's pink and screaming. These are babies that carry on to have a fairly low score. So we try to narrow this down to babies that really should be good by good babies by 5 minutes. This isn't trying to measure whether they're going to have high grade HIE. It's not going to assess whether or not they're going to get into Harvard when they're 18. But we try to, as best we could, find just those babies that really should be doing well.
Other comments? Kathleen?
I just had a question on the references. You said that about 50% of the low APGARs at 5 minutes are related to intrapartum events, but there's no reference cited for that. And so, you know, I, like Julia, was looking for, you know, citations specifically related to the low APGAR, and that one really was interesting because that does give you some ideas, so maybe it could be prevented or not, but I didn't see the reference. So could you provide, or do you know where that's from?
Dr. Mann wrote this, wrote this particular one. We all sign off on all of them, but she was the one getting those references. Susan, are you there still?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a concern with many of the statements which have been made. There are no references, or the references are in different places, which don't actually. It's not well documented.
I found that a challenge, I must say, in reviewing all this. Some of the references are incorrectly cited too. They have like the wrong volume or the wrong year. Uh-huh. I mean, I eventually found most of them, but that was frustrating. And then the just Broadridge comments that this is related to substandard care, no reference. I think it could have been better prepared, I think.
I'll tell you, when I was putting references, I cut and paste them from PubMed. So if there's an issue with which volume, we can talk to them. So the ones that...
Okay.
Any other urgent comments on 5-minute APGAR less than 7?
I was just wondering why you didn't use APGAR at 1 minute rather than APGAR at 5. Because, I mean, most of the indexes relate to kind of like prenatal... like obstetric care, and generally, unless we kind of conceive of the first-minute APGAR score more consistent with, you know, maybe prenatal care versus 5-minute APGAR score is also then dependent on resuscitation, the technique of resuscitation. So
certainly that is true, but there's so many babies who, for various reasons, are born and have a relatively low 1-minute APGAR. You know, precipitous delivery can cause a low 1-minute APGAR, and we certainly wouldn't want to, you know, put that into the numerator. And the other part of that is, yeah, again, remember, this is looking at the overall quality of care, not just the issues related to obstetric management. And so, you know, who's in the room? Are there obstetric nurses doing all that resuscitation? That speaks to the overall labor and delivery care. Just quickly speaking to the using cord gases, it may well be a better measure. It certainly is a better measure of acute acid base. One of the issues there is, remember, the obstetrician is in charge of whether or not that gets sent, and there certainly is a potential for some bias there in terms of whether or not they send it. My guess is that most are sending it to be defensive and oversend. But you could certainly imagine them not wanting to know what that pH is, versus most of these APGARs are being measured by people other than the delivering obstetrician, pediatricians, nurses, et cetera. And so it is a measure that is by somebody who is not as invested in that delivery.
Yeah. APGAR score, as we know, it's a very subjective measure, and there have been multiple studies looking at multiple providers, neonatal providers and pediatric providers doing this and having variable results. So it's not a very good measure. And you can probably mandate, say, hey, if you have these risk factors, then you should get a cord gas. Is that something which you can do? I'm not sure, but...
Okay.
That is actually in guidelines for perinatal care. With, you know, APGAR less than X, you need to get cord gases. And I think, you know, we're at Krako Institution. You don't get it, they're not helping you out when you have to sit in big rooms. Yeah. So I don't see that actually as an impediment. I mean, I don't think people, I think the time that people are, should I send them, should I not send them, the APGAR is good. But the tracing was bad or something else was going on, and you're thinking, do I really want to hang myself with it?
I really don't think people are, I don't think people game that system in the wrong direction, actually. I think if anything, people are getting more information, and it may be medical legally motivated, but nonetheless, I think that they get the information.
Okay, could we please take a vote now on the suitability of 5-minute APCA less than 7 as a component of this measure? So we have 10 yes and 14 no, and we'll turn to Nancy for birth trauma.
The birth trauma measure, if you remember from our discussion yesterday, it is very similar to 474 that we talked about yesterday that we did not endorse. There is one primary difference between 474 and this measure, in that in this measure, brachial plexus injury is included. So I'm not sure we need to revisit all that stuff because it's the same measure. The weights are the same. The ICD-9 codes are the same, except for brachial plexus injury, which is included in this measure.
I just wanted to mention there is one other code that is different from the PSI 17. 767.8 is not included in this measure, in this metric. 767.8 is other specified birth trauma. The other difference is that the denominator here is deliveries, obviously, because it's part of the AOI. So.
Are you done, Nancy? Okay.
You know, I just don't think there's a need based upon the long discussion we had yesterday about this.
Anyone else? Okay, let's take a vote on this. Birth trauma is a component of the index. Yes, others who haven't weighed in?
push, that's appropriate. If you're in Boston, you can push hat.
Okay, so we have eight yes, and 15 no. So we'll turn to Bill Callahan for in-hospital neonatal docs.
Thanks. I have to admit, I was a little bit confused by this measure as specified. In the numerator, it's specified as any inborn discharge disposition of died within 7 days of birth, parentheses, perinatal death, which really isn't a perinatal death. A perinatal death, it's an early neonatal death, so perinatal death would include still fetal deaths. And then in the AOI papers, they specify intrapartum and neonatal death. And again, and more specifically, these are greater than 2,500 grams and more than 37 weeks of term. So I took this on face value to be early neonatal deaths, that is, born alive and died within 7 days of birth. Okay. Obviously, again, this is another rare and sentinel event. There are data that were published in Journal Pediatrics in 2007 that actually looked at this in a different context to compare late preterm births with term births. And as specified in this definition, you eliminate congenital malformations as a cause of death. That would limit this to about 750 deaths a year. About one in five of those deaths would have been assigned a cause of death of birth asphyxia or intrauterine hypoxia, and then the rest various and sundry causes of death. So this represents a fairly heterogeneous and rare group of death. It's difficult to understand for me where sort of the, again, from an accountability standpoint, who is accountable for what. If the intent was that this was about intrapartum management, then I think it gets even sketchier because, again, this is, again, about 750 deaths per year in this group of non-anomalous term fetuses, one in five of which may have been, would have been assigned intrauterine hypoxia and birth asphyxia, and it still remains unclear, I think, in this day and age, how much of that is really and truly intrapartum management, how much of it isn't. From a citation standpoint, there are some citations from some international articles that have more of an international focus, where intrapartum death certainly is a very different phenomenon than it is in the U.S., as well as asphyxia. Some references to infant mortality and neonatal mortality and post-neonatal mortality in general, but not specifically addressing the issue of early-term neonatal mortality. You know, I think again, at the end of the day, from my perspective, this represents a group that it's pretty hard to hold out again for accountability or preventability.
Comments, questions from anyone around the table?
I guess for me it's interesting. It took a group of obstetricians to give their neonatal death only about half the weight than a maternal death. That's a point well taken.
Was the intent basically based around intrapartum management? Because there seems to be the focus of this, although it's been unstated, I think, explicitly, is that this relates to intrapartum care.
Absolutely. This was designed to be around intrapartum management. There have been several other studies looking at entire pregnancy management and various outcome measures associated with management of the entire pregnancy, but this would, the entire AOI has been about measuring quality of care in labor.
But not, for this measure in specifically, not care after delivery. Not
yeah, so correct. So one of the points may be
7 days of life may have been
right.
One of the downsides of AOI.
Yeah, might be his fault. Mm-hmm.
Right. Probably was.
Yes. Yeah, fair enough. And you're right. We did not try to measure this as a, did not include this as a measure of you know, nursery or NICU care.
Okay, one more comment. I think that goes back to the stratification by kind of hospital. And maybe I missed this in here, but you know, in a lot of smaller hospitals, the baby may be admitted to a NICU or a level 2 nursery or something that you would define as a NICU, but then get shipped out to a tertiary care center. And so I couldn't really see how, or didn't quite understand how this would be captured in your index. So they may not die in your hospital. You know, there are some hospitals that pretty much don't want kids to die there, and they'll end up dying somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's a real problem with any measure at any hospital that has the opportunity to transfer out the problem. You know, you're not going to pick that up in the unless the receiving hospital gets dinged for it. You know, you're just not going to get it. But you're not going to get it from the hospital that's doing the transferring, unfortunately.
Yeah, although we do, for the neonatal ICU admission, we do get those transfers. So we would still identify it as a case. We likely would miss the death, and I think that's going to be true for, it was also true for the unplanned procedure, right? But at least we would still get this as an event because it would have been transferred out likely to go to a NICU, and we do capture those.
Can we have a vote then on in-hospital neonatal death as a component of this measure? Okay, so we have 8 yes and 16 no. And Elizabeth, we turn back to you for the final component, admission to NICU at term.
Okay, so this is our last component of our last measure, I think, and shall we go to the harmonization discussion? This is, the measure is for babies who are at least 2,500 grams and 37 weeks that are who are admitted to the NICU within 1 day of birth, and who stay greater than or equal to 1 day in the NICU, or who are transferred within 1 day, which is parallel to the maternal ICU admits. The challenge with this measure is, with the baseline rate reported in the application is 6 to 8%, so it's a high, it's much higher than a lot of the other things we're looking at. The challenge is that, again, the two big challenges are that there's no risk adjustment, and I ensure that both maternal and infant factors contribute to their NICU admission risk. And then thinking about that as a threshold, admission to a NICU or transfer, there is, as we've talked about already, so we don't need to go over it again, a lot of variability of the rates of admissions to NICUs, some of which may be a quality signal, some of which may be a structural or inefficiency signal if hospitals are getting 25% of their visits to NICU, that may be a different kind of signal that we would be getting out of this count that would be feeding into the composite score. Information on the specific form for this subcomponent is pretty brief, and I don't blame the measure developers. This is a lot of it, to fill out 10 different forms for all these outcomes is challenging, but there's very little on the validity of the measure. There is the study studies are really back to the index, not this individual component. There is some look at the data validity, and there's subjective words like that, there was a strong match or whatever, but there's no quantification in the application about how well the different data sources lined up in determining who was admitted to the NICU or not. So I think those are the main points.
Other comments, questions?
I just wanted to mention that one of the ways that we try and do discriminate in terms of the processes at a hospital is that the baby actually has to be in the highest level bed. So many hospitals will have intermediate level beds, they'll have step down beds, they'll have observation beds. So these babies in this 2,500 gram 37 week can be taken care of for a couple days in those types of beds. But if you're putting a baby that without the exclusions, if you're putting a baby in a NICU level bed, then there are other drivers potentially that are causing that. So I think that's why we're trying to discriminate that the baby can't be just in a special care bed, but it has to be in a NICU bed. And so that's why you get those very large numbers of cases. So when hospitals begin to look at their data, they start saying, oh, they really shouldn't be at that level. They should, they could be in an observation bed for rule out sepsis and those types of things. But is it really appropriate care?
So let me just clarify one more thing, which I forgot to mention. This is my 2 out of 2 numerator statements I've incompletely presented to you, so I apologize. But this one does have an exclusion for babies with congenital anomalies, fetal hydrops, dwarfism, or neonatal abstinence syndrome. And codes are provided for those. I think I'm not sure what you just discussed about level of bed addresses the observation we were making earlier that some NICUs, say in a community hospital, there may be a level 2 NICU, and it's really the only place where there are nurses and potentially a on-call resident, for example, this is my experience in a small community New Haven hospital, really able to care for babies that are where there's any concern. And so the threshold for admission is very low versus, say, at a tertiary care center like Yale. So I think that's the difference that we're all acknowledging, and the issue is in a composite measure like this, what would the signal be giving you? You'd be capturing potentially two very different things. One is sort of maybe an inefficiency in the system or a management choice that we don't think makes sense versus a quality signal that was, poor perinatal care during the delivery.
I think for that type of hospital, if the baby really needed the NICU level bed, that baby would not be picked up on this measure. But if the baby were really needed the NICU level, they would be transferred out, and they would be covered under that transfer scenario.
So let me just clarify, because I'm confused then. If the hospital's highest level is a level 2 NICU bed, say a 6-bed NICU, would you count that? That would be a NICU admission, I think, documented in the charges. I don't...
A level 2 bed NICU is driven by the revenue codes, the UB04 revenue codes. So a level 2 bed is coded at 172 or 173. The only ones that we're picking up are 174s.
Okay.
So it has to be truly charged at the NICU level. They may call it a NICU.
Mm-hmm.
At the level 3 NICU level.
Level 3.
NICU. Okay, well, that's a clarification. I think it's not really...
Right.
specified in the form, and again, these forms are kind of endless and they're hard to do, but and let me just say, reviewing it would have, I think, it would be helpful just to have those kinds of details there, and also even just the DRGs listed so that you don't have to look them up as a just a description of the DRG, not just the number, so you don't have to look them up to understand the basic things like numerator and denominator statements. Are we ready to vote? Thank you. Admission to NICU at term as a component of the composite measure. Okay, we're looking for,
press your button again, please.
Okay. So we have 11 yes and 13 no on that. And so Suzanne has prepared a summary slide of our vote. She's just putting in the last one. And then we'll put it up. We had a tie, a no, a yes, a no, and a no, as in terms of the simple majority votes. But now we're going to ask you, with no further discussion, because yeah, okay. So we're going to go through all of the four major NQF criteria, thinking of this composite measure as a whole. So the first question is importance to measure and report. Opening it up for comments.
I wanted to ask you, and Scott and I were just talking, we both have the same question, is on a national level, certainly the maternity field is very premature in terms of our measurement science. A measure like this is extremely complex, certainly now with, we don't know, I think there are now 4 of the 10 are still in there. How do we vote on something like that where we don't now understand, okay, if you redid it with only a few measures and you want to weigh it in a certain way, how would you think about it? And then on a national level, who else are using composite measures? Are they well validated elsewhere? Are there other professions that you see? Then what are examples of those?
Yeah. Two questions. First one is you need to vote on what's presented. So there's no tweaking. You've given a lot of feedback, but that's not what you're voting on. You're voting on what's right here in front of you. Okay? So the second, are other composite measures used? Yeah, they are. There are two basic major kinds of composite measures that we've endorsed. Some of we've endorsed what are several now, what are known as all or none composites, where there will be multiple components, often process measures, but they can be outcome measures, where it's like, for instance, good diabetes care means your hemoglobin A1C is less than, you know, whatever your number is, blood pressure is less than, and, you know, their, you know, whatever, the LDL is less than, and, you know, so, and the patient, in order to get credit for the measure, you have to hit all four, okay? So that's a kind of measure we're seeing a lot more of, and we've endorsed any number of those, and they are being used nationally. The other kind are the kind that Elizabeth worked on, and these are more traditional composites where there's weighting and risk adjustment of the components and, you know, factor analysis, and, you know, they all get kind of put together a little bit odd based on a lot. Microphone, please.
Both are outcomes measures that we've one's just finishing up thing to a process and one's approved. They're risk adjusted, but they're specified in the way that these are. It's one or more of six or seven outcomes. And so we didn't treat them as a component per se. We looked at each of those clinically and at the coding variation and asked a lot of the questions that we talked about today, but they weren't true composites. And I think you know, everything's evolving.
Yeah, and that's one of the evolving issues is when is a composite, and when is it something that there's just multiple criteria to meet for the numerator. And at this point, it's sort of arbitrary, and we're still trying to find our way through that. But there are those kinds of measures endorsed and being used.
Getting back to that then, so one of the main questions that's been brought up all morning is how would the public use this? Like, it's complicated. So how would the public use this? So I guess my question is... Oh, okay. All right. I won't ask the question. I was going to shoot it back to Elizabeth. And, okay. So she told me to stop talking because she wants to.
Other comments on importance to measure and report?
The composite.
Yes. For the overall composite of all 10 components. Okay. Please vote. Okay, so the vote is 7 yes and 17 no. And now we do stop according to the process because the first two criteria are must-pass criteria. Thank you for your work and your time.
Oh, yes. So now I do get to talk? So, no, so one of the major issues, obviously, that we're having with this is if you were to put this out to the public and they're going to compare hospital, you know, we're all getting really, you know, having chest pain thinking about it. So with those composite measures or the whatever you call the measures that you're doing, how is the complexity of those rolled out to the public? Like, what does that look like? I'm just trying to understand.
The two that we've done, they're not publicly reported yet, but I will just tell you, I think the way we'd handle it would be the same as the other outcomes measures. So they're one or more of five or six complications following ICD implantation, and the other one is, similarly, I can't remember off the top, I think it's six or seven different complications following elective hip knee replacement. So it would show up is that there were one or more complications. The drill down data would go to providers so they could have that. And it's reported with a rate, risk-adjusted rate, but also with an uncertainty estimate around that rate, which is challenging enough to communicate to consumers. I'll just make one point I thought about earlier with respect to the usability of this measure, since we're not. It's just worth thinking about when do patients have a lot of choice. So, for example, we developed and CMS reports AMI mortality and AMI readmission risk-adjusted rates on the website Hospital Compare. We don't think of people really choosing their hospital by looking up, you know, that data online when they're having chest pain, speaking of chest pain.
But it's, I would think a little bit more, and you all can tell me more. I know there, you know, payment and provider arrangements with specific hospitals, but the patients might be more sensitive to using this kind of measure to make choice. And so in that sense, I think they should be judicious about putting, you know, you want them to have more information, but this is one that's more likely to get used for patient choice.
I'll take the prerogative. I'd like to introduce the Senior Vice President of Performance Measures here at NQF, Dr. Helen Burson, who snuck in earlier today, and she'd like to make a comment.
So I just wonder if, and that makes complete sense to me, but as I think about it, people are coming in all with one thing. So you had a hip replacement. So everybody had a hip replacement, and then you're going to stratify based on, you know, sort of how you are as a patient or whatever, your age or whatever it is or how sick you are. And that, to me, is straightforward, like we're all talking about the same thing. And a little bit of this is that we're talking about vaginal delivery, we're talking about C-section, and it's not as homogeneous. Like, I don't know whether it would be easier to understand if we were talking about everyone having a vaginal delivery and then every, you know, sort of composite measures or whatever versus, no?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Their expectations are very different.
When I first saw this measure, I was very excited. And I don't want you developers to go away I'm sure you're going to be a little discouraged at this reaction, but I was excited for exactly what Helen was talking about. This is one of the situations in which a woman or a family, because sometimes it's joint decision, can get to choose which facility she goes to. And I'm one of those people who does read Hospital Compare. And when my husband was contemplating a hip replacement, I read all of the stuff that I could find about the Washington, D.C. hospitals. And I think it considerably narrowed his choice of both surgeon and facility. As we worked our way through this measure today, as you can see, there were a number of concerns about a number of the components. And I think part of it is the problem that we're used to dealing with measures individually. We're judging each particular measure on its own bottom. Here we're trying to do a market basket, and that's a little harder to get your head around. But please come back at some point when there are opportunities to do that. Composites are something that we do welcome, and I do think that it can be explained very easily to the patient. And I think, frankly, it's the kind of information that your docs and nurse midwives too, because in Washington we have both, like to know. If you've got a sloppy hospital, you'd like to know it. You don't want to be associated with it, or you'd like to see it get better.
Yeah, I would say, again, echoing the payer perspective, sort of the first introduction of this is very attractive. Huge interest on the part of payers. Enormous interest on the part of plan sponsors, companies that are paying the bill, but it puts a great responsibility on the developers to make sure that these are really the markers of adverse care and that the weight attributed to each of these things really reflects quality and the opportunity to change it. Because as soon as it goes out into the marketplace, the plans, the companies, the plan sponsors, employers will say, ah, this system has a 450 score and this one has 320. I want all of my employees to go here. And I want you to create financial incentives to make sure that happens. So, that, you know, obviously that's how it's used.
I just want to follow up on Laura's point because what you made the point, we just want to distinguish between how we define the cohort of patients we're measuring and then how we define the outcome or a set of composite outcomes. And so for hip and knee surgery, for example, those are elective procedures. We clump them together because they're done by the same surgeons in the same parts of the facility with the same support team. And then we looked at a set of outcomes that we could combine together as, you know, consistent with your strategy to get enough volume to really be able to risk adjust for patient differences and still get some variation that wasn't just due to chance that could be attributed to quality. So the dilemma, you might be able to take it, you need to have some coherence in the cohort you're measuring. If you're throwing in sort of high-risk OB patients, and you know who they are in advance, and they know who they are, you know, you might stratify some OB patients and look at them with a composite outcome and then have sort of, you know, younger, healthy patients without any comorbidities in another group and look at a composite outcome for them. And what you do by doing that is you get more out of your risk adjustment. Technically, it's what you want to do. You want to have clean cohorts. That's part of the sort of standards for outcomes, measures, and risk adjustment. So it's not an either-or. What we're talking about that consumers like is the composite of sort of events at the end. It doesn't mean that you have to smush all the patients together who are different, you know, in order to do those composites. I'm not sure I'm being clear.
No, that was incredibly helpful because that's sort of, it's not that you would think, oh, yeah, I'm going to have a C-section and I want to be in this box because obviously you're thinking I'm going in to have a baby. But I do think patients are pretty sharp. They know when they're high risk. I mean, sometimes they know better than we do. But, I mean, I think that's one way of, that's an easier way for me to think about it in terms of if you're a low-risk person, you're thinking, man, why does that hospital have so many people that are getting blood transfusions? What the heck is going on there? And I would be very suspicious if, you know, you saw that a lot of those low-risk women were getting blood transfusions. But, you know, so maybe that's another thing to consider that I can understand.
So I think this measure has still got life. Here's what I would suggest, because I think this needs to be risk adjusted. I think there are a couple of simple ways to do it. There are sophisticated risk adjustment models. As we've seen the C-section, they've kind of fallen by the wayside. I would do AOIs only in the same population you're doing the normal first term spontaneous singleton vertex rate. And by narrowing the population, and if you stick with the same population the NTSG rate's already doing, the hospitals have already figured out who those people are. Every hospital has low-risk women. Don't hold them responsible for the high risk, but what's happening in that low-risk population, I think that'd be an easy way to resurrect this.
Yeah. First, I want to say thank you all for this. This has been very interesting, very fun for me. I'm an anesthesiologist, so I like getting beat up. Surgeons do this anyway. The questions I was going to ask were, it sounds like risk adjustment, and it sounds like perhaps even you'd be happy with risk adjustment into some rather large categories. So low risk, high risk women perhaps, and maybe even, I'm not sure about cesarean delivery versus vaginal delivery. But certainly even if we were to say low risk, high risk, even that would make you happier with this. That's one. Second, potentially stratifying by levels of care and getting some of that more clearly delineated. We've done some of it, but present some of those data and make that more clear. I know you guys had some questions about the weighting of each of the, and we could certainly go back and, you know, this was done by consensus and we're all going to, you know, if we asked all of us around the table, my guess is we'd get, you know, 43 different answers and there are only 40 of us in the room kind of a thing. And then finally, there are a couple of them, while it seemed to me like most of these 10 you had issues with, you thought there was a reasonable measure potentially, but wanted risk adjustment or with it. There were several that you had real concerns about, and I would say that's third and fourth degree tear, the lacerations, and 5-minute Apgar were the two that it sounds like just basically you had issues with at a basic level of the measure itself.
I think that certainly for Apgar it was the science, I think, which the sort of really
right.
Measuring.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting with. And the third and fourth degree tear, I'm still going to internally push back to, do we do this? This measure is about to be about patients rather than processes of care. So, you know, we'd have to have that conversation ongoing, but.
I think the third measure that got an overwhelming number of no's was uterine rupture.
Yeah.
Right, if we did lower risk there wouldn't be very many. It would almost go, it would likely go away. The vast majority of those either get a if we care about them, they get a transfusion or go to the unit anyway, so we're likely to find them in other
and
ways.
And if you've got a uterine rupture in that situation, you ought to look at that. It really is rare. It does happen, but it's rare.
All right.
Just say one thing. I like the way that you mentioned that it was sort of a one subject, and you said, hey, this is really all about labor care. And maybe you could repackage this in the concept and say it's about care during labor. I never heard that until you said it. I read all the stuff about it and seen this thing and that thing and all over the map, and yet when you said we're really looking at care during labor, how safe is it during labor, maybe if you somehow focus that and that was your message and maybe even change the name of it, you might be in better shape. Well, because if that's what you're trying to measure is safe care during labor, that makes a lot more sense than, all the rest of it.
I have one more question. I know you guys have lots of work to do. There was one sort of opinion piece on this that suggested that we turn it on its head and do 1 minus the AOI in essence. Suggesting that what consumers might want is what percentage of moms go in and have a good, healthy delivery. And therefore, you would say, here we go, 93% of these moms came in and had nothing bad happen to them. As opposed to, here's the percent that had something bad happen to them, if you will.
I can refer you to a paper where I'm the first author called The Ideal Birth Outcome. And so that has been done. Maybe we could work together.
Then I thought about perinatal outcomes. It was like the neonatal death is so rare, probably, but what you're really interested in is some kind of like a cystic event, presumably, right, HIE. So brain cooling really is becoming standard of care. If you could somehow figure out whether an infant gets cooled at this point, then
most of those get transferred out. So we probably we would get the transfer, but we wouldn't know the management.
Thank you. Just another comment, and it came through a few minutes ago, and I'm not sure you guys heard it down there because of some other things that were going on. But is the issue to think about whether or not a concentration might be. The nulliparous women at term, one baby, head down. The same one we've got the suction measure for. And because, we all know very practically, if we do a good job with that birth, chances are the rest of her obstetrical history will be good. Not always, but it's a pretty good predictor that she will labor well in the future or that she will, more successful messing with her in causing things that we really don't want to happen than we are with a subsequent mother. So I would suggest that might be another place to concentrate, and it would partner well with some of the other measures that we voted to endorse. And the second thing is if you look on the American College of Nurse Midwives website, there's a whole web page about the Optimality Index, which comes from Europe, but it's the idea of optimal outcomes. And what does that mean in birth? And so it is that idea of turning it upside down and saying, well, what we're trying to do is promote healthy moms, healthy babies, optimally.
I definitely did hear that. And actually, the other thing that we may do is then go to the other extreme and take the very high risk, leave the middle in. The middle's muddy. And so leave the middle out. Go to the pointy end of the stick with a high risk and define it somehow, figure out what that looks like. Go to the high volume stuff with all those low risks and leave them that messy stuff in the middle out of it. And
okay, you've actually evaluated all the measures put forth to you. However, as we've discussed and you all have raised, we've got several measures that are all about hospital-acquired infections in newborns. And I think the question has been raised multiple times is, you know, what do we do with so many similar measures? And this is a huge and growing issue. In NQF, our members, and frankly, it's a major issue with board of directors. You know, we're really hearing and sensitive to all of the frustrations and logistical challenges out there because we want things being measured, but if the demands are such that we're asking to measure the same thing or very similar things in multiple different ways, resources are wasted and people don't do it. So there's just all the reason in the world to try and be sure that we're not trying to put out there multiple measures that are measuring the same thing differently, but, you know, it, rather than a library trying to help people pick the one that seems to work the best. So a real challenge over the last couple of years has been trying to help committees look at measures side by side. So I'd like you to take a look at the memo you were provided, whether electronically or in paper, on the evaluation of related or competing measures. And what we've done is staff has identified in this particular set of measures that you all have looked at four measures that are very similar. Measure 478, which is the ARC measure on nosocomial bloodstream infection. 1731, which is the healthcare associated bloodstream infection in newborns from the Joint Commission, and realize that those two were intentionally harmonized. Their differences are more about their data source and very little about their construct. So they're essentially very, very much the same measure. And then the two measures from the Vermont-Oxford, the late sepsis or meningitis in neonates, either for all of them or the second measure for the very low birth weight. So when it comes to looking at measures side by side, you know, how do you pick? I mean, what are the principles or what are the values we use to kind of say, you know, what should get maybe more support compared to others? And NQF has developed sort of a selection criteria. I'm not sure. We've used the term best in class. I'm not sure that's the right term to use. But essentially, those principles are around we don't want to try and avoid endorsement of multiple measures unless there's a very good justification. So that's not to say you cannot recommend, you know, several measures. However, we've got to be crystal clear as to why we're doing that, realizing the impact it's going to have out in the field for people actually doing these measures. NQF has a couple preferences when it comes to looking at similar measures. There's a preference for broad target populations. Measures that capture the largest number of patients. You just get more bang for your measurement buck out of a measure that does that. Also, measures that have the broadest levels of analysis. A measure that is that can be applied at the facility level, the plan level, the system level, wherever, you know, has broader applicability and greater utility than a measure that's only for a clinician, only for a hospital, only for this, and you end up with multiple measures that are very related, but they're taking just a tiny slice. We're really looking to not have multiple measures. People are calling it measure clutter. And so we really would like to see measures develop more robustly to be able to capture a large segment of the healthcare system. Harmonization of related measures is absolutely essential. And I think you can understand why. And some of the issues we've got to look at are definitional, because that's the one that kind of drives everybody nuts, you know, defining different data elements differently. And then, of course, the corresponding codes, not the code list being off by one or two And also, because this is an evolutionary process, it, you know, what we don't have that everybody wants when we do these discussions is, okay, did you do, run it both ways and how did it compare? Well, that hasn't been done typically, so we're left sort of ignorant of what that really means in terms of what the results are going to look like one way versus another. But recommending that those analyses be done, you know, is a real important aspect of what we're going to do. So, you know, again, this is a very, very challenging exercise. It's a very, you know, steering committees, I've tried to walk through this with before, difficult times, so I'm just, you know, I get it when you're going to struggle. I'll be there with you. So what I tried to do is these four measures in the memo, I didn't make slides because it just got too much. I put in the side-by-side. Now, just one other thing, which always complicates it, is there is another measure out in one of NQF's other projects, and this is the one I think that Craig has referred to, and that is the measure for CLABSI, central line-associated bloodstream infection, that is for everybody, but it's stratified, and high-risk nurseries or NICUs are one of the strata, okay? So that measure is, you know, sort of close to endorsement, if not absolutely, you know, depends on how, whether all the emails are in or not. And so that is a measure that we also have to realize is in the portfolio. So that's there. So when you look at these measures, what I did was, in the first column is that measure, the CLABSI measure, and I pulled out the elements of it that relate to NICUs. The second column are the harmonized ARC and Joint Commission measures. Now, you know, we've heard from them both that they've spent a lot of time harmonizing them. There are some intrinsic differences, but in general, they're harmonized to the extent possible. And then again, similarly, the two measures from Vermont Oxford, 303 and 304, are the constructs are essentially the same. The risk models are slightly different because one is all of them and the other is a very low birth weight. So I left them kind of in their same columns. And so that's how the side-by-sides laid out for you. I presented committees with side-by-sides where the table goes on for 10 pages, and that really is, you know, makes my eyes spin, too. So I tried to break it up to make it just a tad more readable. And if anybody's got any additional suggestions on how to present these side-by-sides, I'm all ears. So if we look at this, the first row, we're talking about just a description of what these things measure. And the first question is, how alike, how similar, and how different are they? What do each of them really measure? How much overlap is there? And then so in the first group, the CLABSI measure, you're talking about central line or in case umbilical line associated. So if you don't have a line in, you know, you're not in the measure. The middle group, the ARC Joint Commission measure, are bloodstream infections. And then the third is the Vaughn measures are both bloodstream and meningitis. So there's a little bit of difference. And I'm going to ask all of you, particularly our neonatal colleagues, how much overlap? I mean, how similar and how different are these measures?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
You can stop me right in my tracks if you want. But I just can't seem to get past something here. I can't figure out how what happened in the past day in terms of us voting yes for 478 and then no for 1731. So if you want me to hold and we can go through this, but my mind is still sort of stuck on that. So if some folks here can help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah. I think that's a discussion that you need to have when you look at particularly how you evaluated the ARC measure and the Joint Commission measure, because given that the construct's the same and they're intended to be totally aligned with some minor differences that are more related to the data source, actually, I've got, Suzanne just has to enter it, I actually have a table with how you voted on all of them. We just have to put some, this morning one in, and she's going to do that right now. What did you do? Don't do that. So, if you'd like to do that first, that's fine, because I do think that in order to explain your decision-making, I think we do have to revisit the discussion we had this morning versus the one, discussion of the ARC measure, because you did come up quite differently, and the measures are really extremely similar in construct. Now, part of this, I think, is we have to ask ourselves, is were we using the same value system in our minds when we were evaluating the measures? The conversation this morning was a little different than the one yesterday. And did we bring in new thinking that may change how we want to think about our ratings from yesterday? So, you know, optimally, it probably would have been nice to be able to discuss them sort of temporally this in the same time frame, but that just didn't work out with our measure developers. So, you know, Scott, it's fine with me if you want to try and tackle that issue first.
But one of the remarkable things is if you look at just if you scan this, if you look at 1, 2, 3, 4, so feasibility, seems like it may have been a pretty big driver, at least for Kishu, I'm looking like in that second column, in 1731, Scott. For 1731 versus 478, as well as usability. So those seem to be...
The issue you talked about this morning was the coding and more the scientific acceptability. That seemed to be the big issue this morning, yet that didn't get picked up in the conversation yesterday. Did we just kind of overlook it? Or is that a true difference between the measures?
I went back and went through my ICD-9 codes to see if we could really truly pick up what was related in the first few days and afterwards, and that's what made me different on this one today. I don't know if anyone else had that same thought process. As I was looking back through my notes to myself, I realized that the big difference is in the one we discussed today, more of the aspect of could I define which ones were present on admission and which weren't for inborn infants, and that's what drove my thoughts, and then the aha that didn't come into my thinking yesterday.
If you had to go back to yesterday's conversation, would that impact your assessment there? Who was
478 yesterday? I think we had to pull it because I thought, to me, the issue with 731 versus 478 is definitional. It's that you can't exclude by coding those that were present on admission, even though they may not be great. But I think you can with the ARC. I may be wrong.
Is developer Mullen, Patrick, are you on? Patrick, who was here yesterday, was supposed to call in. But the data source for the ARC measure is also administrative data.
Hi. You know, honestly, the code tables are exactly the same for the two measures. We have worked very closely with ARC, with Patrick, to do that. And actually, they have always been very, very close, except for one or two differences, and we have resolved those so that there should be no differences at all. And I think, and, you know, this is sort of a self-serving comment, so forgive me, but, you know, the Joint Commission is quite often criticized, and rightly so sometimes, I guess, that we require, generally speaking, chart abstraction of medical records, and we don't do measures based on administrative data. I just think it is so ironic that we're getting gigged here because we're using coded data as opposed to requiring chart abstraction. And frankly, I'm having a hard time, bringing those two things together too. And if you could help me, I'd appreciate that.
So, okay, so here's my ignorance is going to show up. So if you go back to 478 from yesterday, it says in 2A1.8, denominator exclusions, and this was the thing that I think we were all stuck on. It says, with principal diagnosis code of sepsis or secondary diagnosis code present on admission. So does that work or it doesn't work to exclude those dates? Because this is what it comes down to is, and this doesn't say anything about transfer. So what we were trying to exclude were babies that were inborn who got septic during the delivery. So does this not include that?
Laura, so the denominator does include all newborns and outborns in 478.
But then
with those exclusions.
It says denominator exclusion.
Right.
But then it says.
It does include the outborns, though. And I thought I just heard you say it was only the inborns.
No. These guys, we were trying to figure out how to make the JACO one work, we kept getting stuck on the sort of transfer thing. And the transfer works because that made sense. So I'm just wondering if the way this is written, the denominator exclusions exclude cases with a principal diagnosis code of sepsis or secondary diagnosis code present on admission.
I think Jaleel led this discussion. He said that when the baby is admitted to the NICU, that present on admission is not yet confirmed. It's suspected but not confirmed, so it's not going to come in with the code. And hence you can't.
So then this should look the same as the other one then. Or this has the same fault or same flaw, I should say, fault. Flaw is the other one.
But there
is
that right? There is a teeny bit of a distinction, and it would be great if you had a coder here to confirm I'm telling you the truth. But the newborn, that is the principal diagnosis. A baby born in your hospital, newborn, is the principal diagnosis. Then they could be admitted from labor and delivery with sepsis, okay? That would be excluded from this. New conversation. A baby transferred with sepsis has present on admission. And this present on admission is new within the last, actually ever since we started coding for DVT and all these diagnoses that are hospital acquired, they've been extremely vigilant about applying the present on admission diagnosis to get those exclusions. So the present on admission is to capture your transfers and exclude them.
Okay.
And then the principal diagnosis for a newborn baby is newborn baby, and sepsis would be a diagnosis that the neonatologist would have had to give in that baby on from labor and delivery.
So sepsis and the flaws are the same.
Well, no, because part of the problem is, and tell me if I'm telling tales out of school, is that you can have a newborn baby who looks fine on admission and 2 days later becomes septic as stink, and that's still an early neonatal sepsis. And that would not be in your present on admission or even in the admission codes, but it still counts against the OBs and not the pediatricians.
I agree. I think what we want to have a dichotomous is early onset sepsis versus late onset sepsis. That's what we want to know. And what struck me when we did this discussion today in the morning was the title of the Joint Commission measure, which said health-related bloodstream infection or something like that. I don't have it up here. Healthcare associated. So, which means that it should not include early onset infections. And over here, the 478, which we did not, probably it was one of our, we overlooked it, is that, and partly the reason might be because it says neonatal bloodstream infections and not healthcare associated.
It sounds as though we're revisiting our decision on 478. Is that an option? I mean, we might say no to both of them?
I think that it's going to be very hard for me to explain to the audiences out there for two measures that are as close as these are to have two different decisions. So I would like you to reconcile it. I think that's an important conversation for you to have right now, you know, whichever way you go. But
you know, if they're not the same, it needs to be based on the differences of the measures.
So,
but, and they are very much alike.
So,
I think what struck me to that, sorry, just 1 second. First, I think I really want to recognize that both the Joint Commission and ARC, I think, have done a really, like, an excellent job at putting this together and risk adjustment and getting expert input and all of this. So I think it's a really thorough process. What struck me today that didn't really strike me as much yesterday and probably led me to at least mention it, even though I didn't change my final vote, was that I was concerned that there's really no, sort of, when we talked about this a little bit, like criteria and validation being done. So we know, like, so we have, you know, coding that probably is done as well as you can do it, but do we really, have we really compared those against a gold standard, or at least tested it? So my hesitation was a little bit about making this a measure for public reporting and comparing hospitals when we just have, like, very little information about how much this actually, you know, reflects the truth as close as we can get it, at least. And so that would be my concern with regard to putting this out to the wider community, and I would want to see some kind of information like that.
Period, and I know you have a very rich discussion going, but I had a comment that's related to this discussion. I am here representing the Association of Women's Health Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses, which represents the interests of over 350,000 nurses, as you all know. And I'm very concerned that we have the Joint Commission measure has been well adopted. A lot of hospitals are may not have been reporting it yet publicly, but they are working on it. And very concerned not to have that measure go away. And also, especially since they are so similar, it's so similar to the other measure, unless there was some extremely good reason not to continue to measure this, I think it would be important to have this for the country. The issue of the patients having infection or the locus of the infection, I think would probably be more compelling to me if the rates of these infections were higher than they are. So the total rate of these infections for the hospitals, the 164 hospitals who have publicly reported, is only 0.3%. So I think we might be nitpicking here a little bit on something that may not be a huge, may not be having a huge impact. I don't know, but that would be something I think for future discussion for getting other data on that. And without the measure, I don't know if we'll be able to get those data.
You know, this is something that we have talked about with ARC, believe it or not, in terms of identifying these patients, whether or not we should be adopting the present on admission designation, which is not generally in the medical record. It's the billing designation required by CMS, and that's part of our issue, because our data source is the medical record. It's not the bill, and that is the big difference, actually, between the Joint Commission measure and the ARC measure. But, you know, based on the discussion, I hear you. We hear you in terms of where you're coming from. And I think that what we can do, excuse me, is to evaluate, and actually we sort of have a golden opportunity to do it right now, because as you know, we are in the middle of the reliability tests of this measure. We can actually look at patients in the next, I think we have 6 more hospitals to go to. You know, we can look at those patients who meet the numerator for this measure and look to see what proportion of that group had positive cultures within the first 3 days of birth or whatever, to see if that is a big proportion and if therefore skewing the measure rates. You know, we can do that. We're willing to do that. And we can certainly, of course, I'm saying this like, yes, like that, but we could, I suppose, add a data element that would have to be manually chosen, picked out of the medical record, that says, this is an intrauterine infection. Now, that would be pretty hard, I would think, to define that data element for a non-clinical data abstractor, but, I mean, and we're certainly anxious to make this the best measure that it can be.
So I think my general concern is even lesser about the first 3 days, because I think what you, I think it would be important to look at what you said, you know, during the reliability testing, but I guess my personal feeling, which I don't know would reflect, you know, the wider general population, would be that, that those numbers are probably relatively small overall. But then I think the what I would be a little more concerned on is, like, later on, how reliable is an identification of an infection in the NICU, and how correlated is that with, like, you know, whatever, maybe CDC or other places have defined what they think is sort of the gold standard for whether something is truly an infection, like a positive, you say positive. You have a couple of algorithms to define whether or not, but I think, as you said, you could do this now. If you did a reliability testing, you could, like, look at a chart and determine against a gold standard, you know, how valid this is.
I think that's a good point, but there are two components to the early onset septicemia. So one is babies. These are vulnerable babies who are on extremely critical nursing care, and stopping antibiotics on these babies is something that's huge jitters to everybody. So many of these babies are continued on antibiotics just because they are sick. They don't want to, a provider does not want to stop the antibiotics. So that will also be coded. If it is coded, it is coded as neonatal sepsis. So that is one group, and the second group is a group which is positive blood cultures. So that's confirmed early onset sepsis. So if we can get both of these together, and that's a big group when you say the number of babies who just receive antibiotics for presumed sepsis, that's a big number of babies. So if you can identify both those from the reliability testing, that would be great.
You know, maybe this is sort of a moot discussion anyway, because let's face it, by 2015, they say, or even if it's by 2018 or whatever, these measures are all going to be specified for retrieval from the electronic health record. And what we can't do now with the existing ICD-9 and 10 codes in terms of identifying positive blood cultures, those kinds of things, we will be able to do with the electronic specifications, because that will be a LOINC, you know, it will be defined in LOINC. And so, I don't know, maybe this measure has been in place now for, well, a year, and it seems to have good resonance with the country, and we know that it's going to be transitioned into an electronic measure sometime in the foreseeable future. Is it, and I'm asking you this, this is not a rhetorical question, well, this is what we say at the joint all the time, is the juice worth the squeeze to try and do this at this point?
I just wanted to add from a state perspective that there is such a dearth of measures that can be arrived at without direct chart abstraction, and we are hungry for those types of measures. Those are the kinds of things we're hoping to put on report cards to drive change faster, and I don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good here, where we're not. I applaud the efforts that you have made to try to make this ICD-9-ish. And so just wanted to put that out there. We need more measures like that.
I'm trying to go through, like, these four measures again in my mind to jumble here, but the points that you guys are making today, I'm looking at the neonatologist here, you know, I'm a pediatrician, so don't they apply to 303 and 304 too? I mean, can't you use, I mean, how is it, isn't this based on, I mean, help me here, I'm never being against, this is based on septicemia or bacteremia as well, but it's,
rule out septicemia,
then at the three and three or four, it is with a positive concept, either from blood or...
So suspected vaccinate? Is that reason?
I think to talk about it and develop developer ease, I think the issue is really you're looking at can we trust that what the physician writes in the medical record as an infection and therefore is coded as an infection, because I don't think coders just code stuff willy-nilly, is that right? And you know what? That's really not what this measure is intended to look at. I understand what you're saying and that there might be a problem here, but I think that as far as these measures themselves are concerned, they just reflect what the documentation is in the medical record. And they don't intend or try to identify whether or not that documentation is correct. I think I think you're not looking at the measure as a measure itself.
Just for clarification, I do want to ask one question. With Vaughn, it's clinical people that are doing the data collection, if I understand that correctly. It's not? Not necessarily? Okay. I mean, I know in my facility, it's
when you say clinical,
RNs that are collecting it.
Well, in our institution, it is a research nurse, but I don't know in all other places what he would personally.
Okay. But then my question is 1731 and as far as that goes, 478, are those bloodstream infections that you're asking about? Are bloodstream infections related to the hospitalization? Because Vaughn, in my opinion, is looking at those related to care in the hospital, something that we can do something about and improve performance with, as I said, maybe 900 facilities, even though it's a subset of facilities. Whereas this, I'm not sure, it's just looking at the global bloodstream infection, if I understand it.
That's not entirely true. What we are attempting to do, what ARC is attempting to do, is to eliminate those patients who are admitted to our hospital already infected, whether that means they're coming, you know, out of the uterus already infected or they're coming from another hospital already infected. And the problem is there is no way to differentiate. There is people who are transferred in, and I think both of these measures do a good job of that. And I think what the concern has been this morning is that there is not a good way of identifying patients who are infected intrauterinely, and Vaughn can't do it either.
But actually, I mean, I think
that's quite accurate. We collect information about early sepsis separately from late infection.
I would like to mention two things about the measure title of the Joint Commission measure. One is it is healthcare associated. If you are deriving this information from coding, then it is a combination of both early onset sepsis and late onset sepsis and this presumed sepsis. So that is not clearly purely healthcare associated. And the second thing is bloodstream. If you are deriving this from coding, it is not a bloodstream infection because it is not a documented bloodstream infection. The code just says neonatal sepsis. So it's not a bloodstream infection either. So the measure title itself is not accurate.
Well, we can certainly change the title of the measure.
So
I don't think it's just the title of the measure. I wouldn't be like so nitpicky. Like, personally, I don't feel that nitpicky about that. But I don't feel like for national quality benchmarking, public benchmarking. I don't really feel like I'm being like extravagant in asking that, you know, coded data be validated against like a gold standard, you know, especially if you have the opportunity to do it, like right, and, you know, with the charts that you're reviewing right now. So I'm.
But yeah, I have a question about that.
Go ahead.
So, because initially what got us off to a sort of different tangent on 1731 was the sense that what you would try and change, if you had a high rate at your hospital, what you would try to change would be whatever practice is happening in your NICU that's giving your babies infections. And so what you wanted to do was carve out those babies who actually got infected in the NICU and not include the babies who got infected in the uterus. So that's how we started the conversation down this path. It's not clear to me how the validation is gonna get to that. And I actually don't even think you can get there, because if you think about it, clinically we can't figure out who's even infected in utero. If the mother's even infected or the baby's infected, and then the baby comes out and it takes, you know, you'll never be able to sort of even clinically answer the question, who got infected in the uterus and who was really the baby who happened to be there. And on day four, the kid's sick. Most of those kids are on antibiotics anyway, right? Just because they're PROM or because they're preterm labor, everybody says they must have been infected. So they're already on antibiotics. So I'm not sure that...
I think we're talking about two different issues. So I think there's two different issues. I think there's one that's the... There's the early onset differentiation for treatment, you know, suspected sepsis, you know, during the first maybe 48, 72 hours of life. And then there's an issue about, to me, about the data validity much later on during the course of the hospitalization, where, you know, you have, and maybe you can educate me how the coders usually handle that data. You know, we have a resident or a nurse practitioner, an attending, multiple people, charting on the same patient. If a baby has Willard neck, you know, the baby gets started on antibiotics, you know, somebody writes like Willard sepsis at the same time, because we don't know if the baby has neck or sepsis at the same, like, you know, what it is, low bowel sounds, you know, so they get started for like a 48-hour watch. Not really sure, you know, great stage one neck is essentially defined as a, you know, as a hodgepodge of like it could be almost anything. And then, you know, the attending may not feel like that to say you really have an infection, but somebody else is coded this as an infection, the cultures are negative, you get 5 days, 6 days, 7 days of antibiotics, and, you know, it gets, so it may permutate with a coder extracting it as an infection when the baby never really had a positive culture or an infection. And so I just feel like just, there may be issues around extracting, typical for coded data, I guess, you know, just extracting whatever the truth is from the chart.
So are you saying that if that part of the study was done, if they went back and validated the fact that the coding, whatever the heck that, wherever they got it from, actually reflected some positive blood cultures, that you would be fine with it?
Yeah, no, I think I would need...
How then do you answer the first part of the issue? Is that a big deal or no?
Well, so, I mean, what I've tried to say before is I think the actual incidence of early onset sepsis is probably very low. I think Joe Carpenter is on the phone from Barnum. He may be able to give us numbers. I'm not sure but the times we truly see positive blood cultures at birth, probably not terribly high. So I don't know, compared to the overall infection rates, whether it makes much of a difference. So my real concern is mostly about just the validation of the, and I think Jaleel has more concerns about the early onset infection maybe than I understand his reasoning. So I feel like, but for both of these, I think these are two separate questions slightly, but I think both of these questions could be answered during the chart review.
But if you don't mind, I just want to bring up the issue about UHC, and I don't know if anybody else here participates in UHC, but the problem is that what we're seeing within institutions is using administrative data, because we may have coders who are very talented and they've been told to capture every single piece of information and code it. For example, accidental punctures and lacerations. I don't know how many of you are following that. What we're finding in our institution is doing a laparoscopy and quote-unquote rupturing an ovarian cyst is coded as an accidental puncture or laceration. or, you know, putting a, you know, cutting the uterus when you're actually taking it out. So we're doing a big documentation project at the Cleveland Clinic to try to have communication with our coders to understand what's a technical error that really needs to be coded as an accidental puncture or laceration versus something that's a normal course. For example, the normal course in a very preterm baby is to put them on antibiotics. That would be read out, though, by your coder as probably a sepsis diagnosis. So I think that's really the concern here, is that I think when you get down to it, our coding data doesn't really reflect on the truth.
Or we don't. I mean, are you saying we don't know whether or not the coding data
right, until you really get to the level of the chart review.
So then the only thing I would bring up is that we have the same issue then. 478 and 1731 suffer from the same, if that's the real concern, both measures suffer from the same issue. So we probably need to go one way or the other. I mean, it makes no sense to have, and the title is not the reason to, do you know what I'm saying? So I think
I just mentioned about the title because it was, that was the prompt for me. I agree. If the coding is the same in both these places, then I think both need to be weighed the same or valued the same.
Can I just ask?
Hello? For Hello, can I speak?
Yes, please.
Hello?
We're listening.
Oh, hi. This is Patrick Romano. I'm not sure. I just joined it about 20 minutes ago. I'm on the phone from California today, but again, representing AHRQ. Can people hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just wanted to point out one thing that I think may not be apparent in this discussion, which is that the logic of this indicator in both of our harmonized specifications requires a specific organism to be identified. So I don't think that the concern about culture-negative infections applies. If you look at the architecture of the numerator specification, it requires the identification of staphylococcus, either methicillin-resistant or methicillin-sensitive, a gram-negative pathogen such as E. coli, Pseudomonas, or serratia, or disseminated candidiasis. So there's no way that this could be triggered unless there's a code for a specific pathogen. And, of course, a coder would have no basis for applying such a code without a positive culture result. Obviously, we look forward to the opportunity to, you know, validate this in collaboration with the Joint Commission, but I don't think that people would be sort of inventing organisms as they code the record. The logic does require that if the hospital reports the diagnosis of neonatal sepsis, they must also report a separate code documenting the pathogen that was identified. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's very helpful.
That is extremely helpful and answers your question. Does it not?
Is that true for the Joint Commission measure as well?
It's the same.
We harmonized IC9 and specification. The only difference that Celeste has mentioned is that in the reporting to Joint Commission, the hospital would have the opportunity to override, you know, what's in the administrative data if it felt that there was an error. Am I saying that correctly, Celeste?
This is Ann Patrick, and actually not entirely, but you know, generally speaking, we don't give abstractors the capability to say, oh, no, that's not the right code, therefore I'm not going to use it. The intent of our measure is that the codes as they exist are the codes that are used.
I think that was not clear when we discussed this with the Joint Commission measure, that the concern I had and which I clearly voiced out was that there will be a significant number of babies who will be culture negative and will be coded as neonatal sepsis. So it was not clear when we did the Joint Commission measure.
So can we re-vote?
Well, okay. Can I ask one question? Since you said they were the same, in the document that was submitted, where is that? I found it clearly in 478, but I can't find it in 1731.
Where is what?
As Patrick was saying, that you have...
It's that, excuse me for interrupting, okay. It's those tables that we, you know, reeled off this morning. They are exactly what Patrick just reeled off. The 11, 10, 2, 11, 11.
Yeah, 11, 11 is the one...
Streptococcus group, D. enterococcus, staphylococcus, unspecified staphylococcus aureus, other staphylococcus, Friedlander's bacillus, Klebsiella pneumoniae, E. coli, and Pseudomonas. They're all there.
But it's in a separate document. It's not in this submission.
Yes, it is in this submission. It is in a table that is referred to in this submission and was included.
And I might also clarify that what we tried to do with our expert panels, and I think the Joint Commission had this discussion as well, was to specifically exclude some infections such as group B strep or listeria that are overwhelmingly perinatally acquired. Now, of course, thanks to antibiotic treatment, we don't see nearly as much group B strep as we did when I was in training, but still, those organisms that are specifically perinatally acquired are excluded from this list.
If 478 had the list in it, whereas this was you had a link to it to get online to the table.
Can we go back and now vote on 1731? Are people okay? Is that, have we discussed this to death now? No, we go through the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, this one we all loved. Let's go on to the next one. Scientific acceptability. Right, because that's where it started to go in the wrong direction. Okay. So we're re-voting on 1731 for scientific acceptability. Everybody press your button again. I don't even know how many people are still here, though. We are 21. Okay, perfect. Oh, there you go. Oh, so it's 21 yes and no no's. Can we move on? And now we'll do usability. Nine high, 12 moderate. And then we'll go on to feasibility. Yep, we're there. Seven high, 14 moderate. And now overall suitability for endorsement.
go.
21 yes, no no's.
Okay.
So then it looks a little bit closer.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've now voted yes on both. I'm sorry, on all four. And we're now trying to narrow that?
Well, you've recommended four measures which you have identified as being similar. And you've already brought up the issue that that can cause issues out in the field, implementation, you know, demands on hospitals. I think you need to have a further discussion about the implications and the impact of the recommendations you're making on these very similar measures. I think one of the first questions I wanted to know, because I really am not totally clear, is how much overlap? Are these really that similar? Is there something really different about some of them, maybe? Because it really is the 478, 731, we've already just determined they're the same. And 304 and 303 are pretty much the same thing. It's just one's a subset of the other for the very low birth weight. So the constructs and the are pretty much the same. The question is, are they measuring the same thing? Or are they measuring something different?
And before we get too far, how does CLABSI factor into this?
Well, realize that there is a measure also that includes NICUs for CLABSI. So that's just another one that's out there. You can't act on it, but to know that it exists in N2F's endorsed measure portfolio is, you know, it, again, is related.
My understanding was, from yesterday's conversation, was that one of the things that was unique about Vaughn is that it sort of run more like a registry than anything else, and that there's additional criteria for patients in the Vaughn network to be sort of counted towards all kinds of data collection. So if we ask if that's true, and we ask Vaughn to harmonize with these others, then they're going to deharmonize with a lot of other things within the Vaughn measurement system. And that seems to me to be a reasonable excuse to let it be slightly different.
Another difference is Vaughn has a number of modifications for gram-negative bacteria, which we've mentioned are very common, and often it's unclear as to the severity of those infections. And so Vaughn has spent more time thinking about how risky are those and which ones are meaningful versus this measure, which doesn't. So that is, you're measuring two slightly different things.
So I would say I think the CLABSI measure is a little bit different. I mean, maybe you could argue that the underlying processes are still rather similar, but CLABSI is used like in large state collaboratives. Now there are specific bundles for it, and so I think, you know, because it's restricted just to Lyme infections, it's a little bit different. I think the other measures are, I would see a large degree of overlap overall between the other measures, personally. I do see, there might be slight differences, but overall, I think they're all measuring, you know, bloodstream infection in a pretty large number of at-risk babies. I don't think I can like easily say based on the scientific merits of these measures whether any would be more superior than the other. I think it kind of comes to me personally, it would come down to like issues such as feasibility and, you know, what's already being done. So the easier it is to get, or, you know, the larger number of places already doing some collection would trump in my ordering in my head for this, but I don't think we need all four measures for all hospitals.
Yeah, I think Chuck, I think you actually had a question for the Vaughn folks, meaning, right?
Yeah, okay, so yeah, it should have been in the form of a question, yeah. Is there definitional issues about how patients are counted in the Vaughn network and excluded from both numerators and denominators as general things that would make it hard to harmonize with these other two measures?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. When you say, are there definitional issues? I mean, are you asking what are the criteria of eligibility for the Vaughn?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I mean.
that born in the hospital, that within 401 to 1500 grams or 22 to 29 weeks, or who's admitted to that hospital within 28 days of life. That's the very low birth weight measure. We reported for all the very low birth weight infants, as well as for infants 501 to 1500 grams, for example. Now, the other measure, 303, includes any infant that's admitted to an NICU within 28 days of life at the reporting hospital, or who dies at the hospital on a particular day 28, as well as the very low birth weight population I mentioned.
One of the things that I think is difficult about this whole issue is the fact that all of these measures they're slightly different data platforms, and which means they're likely to be somewhat different users. The ARC measures are clearly used often at state level, and I don't know, purchasers use them, and so because they're purely administrative database, Rebecca mentioned that. The Joint Commissions are administrative plus. So there's some extra chart review and using their specific methodology, but we've already determined that the two of them are as aligned as much as possible. The Vaughan measures are just a completely different data source. And, you know, it's a registry. We don't have any head-to-head comparisons. I guess, you know, and does that mean they have different users?
I mean, I don't mean to speak for that. I would just ask Vaughan to respond. You're
sure.
Looking at me, but...
You know, I'm
so
looking at you because your hospital is... How many of these does your hospital, do?
I assume we do all of them currently, probably. You know, I'm not in the measurement department of my hospital, but, you know, I know we do the CLABSI for once go to the CDC, for sure. You know, we code all these things, so I'm sure HRQ could take probably part of Joint Commission also, so we're probably doing that effort as well.
Yeah.
But I'm just, like, I guess as a value, so I'm trying to think about it as a value to the frontline provider who's trying to reduce healthcare infections. It's like, I don't need four of these. That's like, maybe CLABSI plus one of the others. You know, I think three, like the BLBW measures, maybe, like before I said, like they're all kind of overlap, but maybe like there's a BLBW measure from one a little different because all the other measures cover larger baby also. But otherwise, you know, I think the general gist of this is that the users of the Vaughan are largely going to be the NICUs directly. And maybe an extension to the NICUs, the hospitals that ask, you know, the board of the hospital that ask the NICU director to present their data. And then through Vaughan, there's also families in a lot of NICUs have access to that data, but that's dependent on the NICU's use.
I guess my issue is, are we really targeting the line use? Because when we look at the part 1A3 on 1731, there are five citations, and it says that the risk factors are decreasing birth weight, central venous catheter use, prolonged parenteral nutrition, and prolonged ventilation. So is the point really to target careful use of central lines and reducing central line infection? I guess that's really my question, even to Joint Commission.
Yeah, I think we know that, like, the overall infection rates, if you look at just CLABSI rates versus overall infection rates, there's substantial differences. And I think CLABSI is also now being used for, as a part of the world's U.S. News, World Health Report. So it is, right? So, we haven't talked about CLABSI, but there's, you know, when you talk to IED specialists within each hospital, there's some leeway to decide of what are we going to call a CLABSI and what are we not going to call a CLABSI. And, you know, so there's going to be some wiggle room around those things where, you know, you may not have perfect data from each hospital either. But it comes back, I think, to sort of philosophical idea about what are we trying to do. And I don't know if I have a perfect solution to this. I think that, you know, the use, I think all of these measures are reasonable measures, and they're well, you know, they're obviously, all of them have had a lot of input from a lot of people, and they're well developed. I would just make, if I was a hospital CEO, I'd want to go ahead and shoot myself, like, over having to report four different measures.
So how about Terry or Jenny, you guys are often on the front lines for this kind of stuff.
Okay. I know that we do provide the CDC measure, and we do Vaughn also. So having to do, we have chosen not to do the Joint Commission just for that fact that we know we have to do the CDC. Vaughn we use internally for data because we're already collecting a lot of other measures with it. So that's my take on that side.
So I agree with Dr. Prophet. The CLABSI is sort of kind of different measure, and it would probably be useful to have that as a separate measure. These four, there is a significant amount of overlap. If you have a Venn diagram, most of them will be covered by all these four measures. So then it comes to me as to if I have to pick one, which one would I pick? If I just had one choice, then I would say, which one is it? 304, which is late sepsis and meningitis in very low birth weight infants. So that's the most obvious of one. So that's my preference, but again, that's
okay. You also have to think about real-world application. I would argue 5 years from now we won't need different ones, but now we do. In Louisiana, I just paid to aggregate all of our Vaughn data. We have 17 NICUs who report that it's an excellent measure. But for the other half of our NICUs, it's just not approachable. We can't get, so are we going to make a decision that will exclude other metrics that use ICD-9 or 10 coding because Vaughn is slightly better? And then make a decision that we're not going to get data from then our hospitals that don't participate in Vaughn, which is associated with a cost? Or do we just say right now in our real-world healthcare measurement world, we have different ways of collecting data, and also hospitals are not required to report JCO measures now. They ought to be, I think, on a lot of these required, but they're not now. And so they don't, if they want to make a decision to report Vaughn, they'll do that. If they don't report Vaughn, they'll do what's convenient for them, but at least it will give us some data that we can use for quality improvement.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
And I would just add that this doesn't just comes up in the measures that my group works on as well, because their registry measures and their claims-based measures, and sometimes actually we're intentionally developing them in parallel because only a certain proportion of hospitals are going to participate in registries. We don't want to undermine what they're doing because sometimes and oftentimes those are the very best measures, but we don't want to wait or require every hospital to join a private registry. So I think the marginal cost to the hospital, I think it's difficult to, you know, to look at four different measures, or it's really three different measure results because the ARC, the ARC and the JC measure are the same. But I would just say right now it's not a lot of, I'm not hearing that it's a lot of marginal burden. If you're in Vaughn, then you get this measure result. And then the other ones are claims-based, so it's not a burden on the hospital. So I don't think we're generating an excessive burden by allowing all these measures to stand at this point.
I think the level three centers in our area are we already going to Vaughn, so that's what they would choose. But the level two centers, they most likely are going to choose ARC or Joint Commission. So it just depends on the facility.
And that was the reason for approving both yesterday. That was the discussion.
Well, yeah. It sounds like everybody's saying we need at least two, right? So at least 303, 304, and one of 478 or 1731. Is that, am I hearing that reasonably? Yeah.
Okay. Just to confuse it slightly, I mean, as Rita said, CLABSIs are required in many states. And in fact, beginning first of the year, most hospitals in the United States will have to collect CLABSI data. And whether their state requires it or not, for CMS, they're going to have to collect that data. And most pediatric hospitals do Vaughn, or they're in Vaughn, and so they're also doing the CLABSI because they're required. And so we're in the same situation. We chose not to do ARC or the Joint Commission because we're doing the NHSM system.
And it's separate groups. So it's, even though it's a third measure, and my concern with all of this is you will get slightly different rates or percentages of infections depending on which one. Vaughn, which is very good, they have definitional problems that the CDC does not like as far as it goes with staff epi. HRQ and the Joint Commission, using coding data, you only have to have one positive culture. In NHSN, you have, depending on the pathogen, you have to have more than one positive. So whatever is recommended, it depends upon whose ox is going to get gored, so to speak, when it's presented to the board, because your numbers may look good with one system and not so good with another.
So at the end of the day, we can't really control what people do with the data and who gets gored, but we can at least make sure that the measures are available so that they can choose, so that they at least have a menu and they can choose. Would that be fair?
I don't want to lose Rebecca's comment because I'm sitting here wearing my old purchaser hat. I don't have access to Vaughn data if I'm a state Medicaid administrator. I don't necessarily have access to Jake Commission data, but I have more likely to. By hospital? I didn't remember that you were.
And with Vaughn, it's totally, it's blinded. So even though I've paid for the data, I can't report which hospital it is. That is the mantra of Vaughn. And so for a public reporting, and it's fine, that's good for quality improvement, but for public reporting, it's useless. And unless, I mean, you can see trends, but you're not going to be able to see which hospital can I go to for better care.
What I wanted to say is, as this goes forward, if we end up recommending all three measures, I think that the record should be very clear that there are considerations for hospitals which are entirely reasonable. I'm not going to do Jake Commission because I'm doing Vaughn. But at the same time, what we're hoping is that this is accessible to purchasers, public and private. And therefore, we don't want to discourage the adoption of a very similar measure that could be publicly available, such as the commission's.
I guess the question I would put to you at this point is, do you feel strongly enough that you really need to, make a selection among the four? Can you live with the pushback you're going to get by recommending four?
This is Kim. Am I really recommending four, or I've endorsed four? They can do whatever they want.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a philosophical issue around N2F. It's been there since the very beginning. Do we create a library, or are we trying to be more directive? And that comes and goes. But I can tell you that, to standardize so that everybody's doing the same thing, it fosters comparability, fosters standardization. So that this is a tension that's very real.
Right. And that's why I've said what I said about making sure the record is clear as to why if we go forward with four, we're going forward with four, we're going forward with three. Because as it goes up to CSAC and as it goes to the board, there will be questions raised of why all four or all three.
It's not that these issues aren't valid. I mean, with justification, now not everybody's going to agree with your justification, but as long as we can clearly articulate the reasoning, and that's what you've done over the last hour. So I think we're there. I just need it to be your decision.
Is there anyone who choose between 303 and 304? No.
Depends on what you're measuring.
Right.
I guess my concern with leaving all four on the table is you're leaving the opportunity to game the system, okay? And I know that sounds very negative, but I'm in a situation where we're bringing together a lot of hospitals who have different backgrounds as far as how they track things, and they may choose, they say, we've always done this, therefore we do this, and we're going to look unfavorable if we switch to that. So, this isn't something I directly am involved in, but when we talk about even within internal hospital systems, leaving so many options out there, I think makes it harder to align care and to really compare. You really should be comparing apples to apples. I guess that would be my concern.
No, I think I get what you're saying, Sharon. I don't know if I totally agree. What I'm struggling with are the criteria that you put out here for us, Reba, which I'm specifically thinking about how to reach as many possible individuals and entities. And if that's what we really want to do, then I feel sort of stuck, because I really want one. But you have however many number of hospitals, 900, whatever it is, they're already reporting into Vaughn. That's huge. I mean, you know, that is just huge. At the same time, that's not public data, right? So where's the accountability piece? It's up to the hospital. So, you know, that's where I get torn, because, like, I would like one. I'm thinking, okay, do we make it just one topic, and then you can have a couple of choices underneath? That's going to upset people, too, I'm sure, or confuse people. So that's why, I mean, the fact that we're harmonized with, you know, ARC and Joint Commission, I think of that more as one, just like you. And I would love to see a choice between 303 and 304, if we could. I hear that that's not as helpful from a practical standpoint, but we are going to get pushback if we approve three, and we do have to decide, Reva, if we can live with it. And for me, I think I can live with it with the rationale. I'd like to as well, but with the rationale of we're reaching as many possible individuals and entities as possible. But it's that public reporting piece that we just don't have through Vaughn, which is, yeah.
My understanding was it's not four measures, we're talking about three, that we've been harmonized, right, Patrick? And I mean, that has already happened. So when you say four, let's at least make it only three.
Unfortunately, that doesn't apply because, you know, two is two. They need to be harmonized, but, you know, for those folks who count the 700 measures in our portfolio and wonder why in the world we have so many, it's two.
Right. I mean, I think, I don't know if the 700 number is some, you know, automatically evil number, but the point, I think, is to have measures that can be applied by a variety of different users and stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do is set things up so that if a hospital chooses to participate in the Joint Commission perinatal measure set, they have a measure that they can use. If they choose not to do that, if an insurance company or a researcher or some other organization that has access to administrative data, all payer administrative data, wishes to look at the same phenomenon, they have a measure that they can use, and those measures have been harmonized. So I don't, in a world where we have different data streams that are under the control of different organizations following different paths, I don't quite see how to get around this problem, at least until we reach the nirvana of the electronic health record, where all this information can be accessed by anyone.
The point that keeps coming up about Vaughn not being publicly disclosed, isn't the whole point of them having brought it here is so that it ultimately will be publicly disclosed?
A couple of avenues. A measure that's endorsed by N2F, we make those measure specifications available. They could be adopted by non-Vaughn folks to be implemented in their facility and used and adopted in some other way. So we aren't endorsing the Vaughn registry per se. And then each of those potential users determines, you know, the how they will use in public reporting. Now, certainly one of the things we encourage, and we're really looking for measures to become more publicly available, and that would be one of the things we really want to encourage. But it's not absolutely required.
So that was kind of my question. So if Medicaid, you know, so Vaughn is proprietary, but if Medicaid said, well, we want from all hospitals, you know, data specified just as the Vaughn does, or like the Joint Commission does, you know, what keeps them from theoretically doing, like, is it really our role to say, you know, we want a measure for X, Y, and Z so that every stakeholder can get at it? Or is it a role for us to say, okay, we think, you know, X, Y, like this seems to be a measure that makes the most sense as it currently is, and it is up to the policymakers to take it further. You know, I guess I'm not quite clear what the overlap or the frontier there is.
Unfortunately, Joachim, it's not quite that simple. If I said I want all the hospitals to use the Vaughn specs and submit the following data to me, I wouldn't have any way to gather it, aggregate it, sort it, analyze it, or spit it back out. what it's not just the specs that you're buying, in essence. What I would like to have is let there be an agreement between Vaughn and X that you'll send the data to Vaughn, and Vaughn will share it with whomever I, the hospital, has agreed can have it. That would be the nice way to do it. But presently, that's not the way it usually works.
Can I make a suggestion? So I like the 304 data as a measure, we are a part of one as well at UT Southwestern, and we appreciate the work that they are doing. But for simplicity's sake, can we do this, that since all these four measures almost measure the same, harmonize 478 and 173 and pick that? What's the downside of doing that?
So you're saying what Pat and I were sort of motioning too, right?
No.
So either, just one.
Harmonize 478 and 1731, which they are.
So that's one.
So that's one. That's it.
And so just pick that.
And pick that.
Just select one of them.
Since the theme is public reporting and one's data is not available to everybody, it might make sense to harmonize 478 and 1731, which is already done, and pick that.
I also wanted to...
Is there any objection to that, or are there any downsides to that? I don't know.
Yeah. I also would vote, to decertify or whatever it is, the Vaughn, because they don't speak for public disclosure, so why should they be the custodian of the measure? And I don't care whether it's AHRQ or the Joint Commission, but I don't see why we can't, get rid of one of them and just have one measure. And if Vaughn wants to go and enter into negotiations with the other two parties who figured out how to do it, right, how to harmonize, and if they want to enter into negotiations and harmonize all of them, I think that would be great, but I think the burden should be on Vaughn.
I guess.
So, if I can say a word, this is Joe Carpenter, Vaughn. the concerns about extracting ICD-9 data at this point are that we want to be able to differentiate infections reliably. So, we have identified specific pathogens that constitute infections, as well as a clear definition of coag negative staff that we consider reliable data. And the issue that was brought up before about the reliability of the ICD-9 data are important to us. We're certainly considering using administrative data in the future and ways that we might do that reliably, but it may be some time. So I would just say that you're right, we are oriented toward quality improvement, and we don't, as an organization, publicly report data, but we do encourage transparency. We leave it up to the hospitals. So I just want to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to make that point, too. I think really very strongly as a developer or someone who believes in quality and someone who does performance improvement that we need both of them. So if we're going to reduce it, we should reduce it to two. And I think the reason, being able to do it from both administrative data and from chart audit, it's the same as sort of the randomized control trial where there's the effectiveness studies and then the real-life efficacy studies. And the data registries will be the effectiveness and the administrative data are your efficacy. And I think that having the opportunity to do it both ways is important.
Yeah, I don't necessarily object to that myself. Could we get a...
All day.
But could we get a sense of like what is it? So for AFLQ, we heard yesterday that essentially no extra work is required for the hospital to collect it, right? So I'm sorry, like I'm trying to like still like there's no hospital representative. For, you know, maybe Terry's a hospital representative. But you know, so for Joint Commission, could you tell us like what is the like what does the hospital have to pay essentially for this each data point or anything? Maybe they have to pay nothing. Then we think we're all very happy, and we can just endorse it.
The Joint Commission measures can be used by go to the website. All of our specifications are publicly available, free of charge. If hospitals choose to collect the perinatal care measure set, and remember this is just one measure in a set of five, then they want that to be reported to the Joint Commission, then they contract with a performance measurement system vendor who actually the vendor provides the data collection tool, which we validate and all of those good things that you read in this stuff. And then the hospital collects the data using that vendor's tool. The vendor, we have a zillion different quality checks that these data are required to be cleaned through, and then the data come from the vendor to the Joint Commission. There is a charge to the hospital from the vendor, not from the Joint Commission, and that's up to the vendor.
The charge would be the initial setting up of the query, pulling all the information, then after that it's really a push of a button. And it goes once we've validated it. So it's not a manual extraction at all. And I am comfortable with the fact that we're going to collect Vaughn no matter what. We'll collect NHSN no matter what. So moving forward with that, I'm fine if we do not recommend it.
Yeah, I was just to move us along, willing to make a motion that we keep harmonized 748 and 731. So that's one measure. And that we keep 304? Was that the one? Was that the base, or was it 303?
Take off both, I would say.
Take off both?
Mm-hmm.
304?
Two is a compromise, I
think. Two is a compromise. So our harmonized one in 304. So that's a motion. Well,
478 or 1731.
I mean,
it's your decision that you have to pick one. Okay, that's the whole point. Is you have to decide. But certainly, we've heard all the arguments why four is not, you know, highly desirable, and there are real issues around coming down to one. As long as you can explain and justify, you can pick one, two, three, or four.
It sounds like we have a justification for why you might want to have something other than Vaughn because it's not publicly reported. So that's a reasonable differentiation there. But then beyond that, we got to come up and decide. Okay, that's fine. But then beyond that, we need to decide whether we feel comfortable having three, which would be 478, 1731, and whichever one, 303 or 304, or whether we really just want two. And you had a comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To state maybe the obvious.
If 1731, the determination were made to not endorse that measure, then if that measure went away from the Joint Commission's stable of measures, that eliminates a whole data pathway. You know, this is an established method for hospitals to collect these data and to get them publicly reported. And if that goes away, I don't know that there is a similar infrastructure developed for collection of the 478 measure.
Or you'd have to start over. Meaning you'd have to. You could potentially then consider the ARC measure. I don't really. I'm not quite sure how we got here, but. Right? I mean, if we chose one and for some reason we chose the ARC one.
Can I give you a little bit of history here? When we, the Joint Commission, decided to develop or put forward this perinatal care measure set, we chose from the already endorsed, and it was right after the endorsement, already endorsed perinatal care measures. Our measure is the ARC measure. And so, but here's the thing, and I don't want to say anything to denigrate ARC or the ARC measures or anything else. We maintain this measure. We update it every 6 months. It's published, those kinds of things. And that would go away because we would no longer be the measure steward. ARC would do whatever it is that ARC does, and they do it very well, but the Joint Commission would not be maintaining a measure that we are not the steward for. That's the bottom line, to be blunt.
Just before we, I just want to, there was a, we went a little bit past a very bold suggestion that came from two people, Jaleel, well, and Chuck, basically. It was, it would be a bold step for this committee to recommend one measure. And I feel like we're, Well, I don't know. We didn't really...
I'm still not clear on why we need to. If you can explain it, somebody who's opposed to having just one, if they can explain it to me, why we need to.
You're saying that I think because, and from the Vaughn perspective, that they're going to collect this. I heard, I think Dr. Prophet said, they're going to do it anyway. You're a member of Vaughn, you're going to collect it. It's a great measure, and 900 hospitals.
And all the hospitals who are members of Vaughn will get that information anyway. So why do we need a second one for the whole community?
One thing I'd like to remember, too, when we originally did this, between the difference between the ARC and the Joint Commission, the ARC one we all passed unanimously right out of the gate, really not much question about it. The Joint Commission one we debated for quite a long time, and maybe it's just the way it's written because we've determined they are very well the same thing. But the ARC one seemed to be pretty well cut and dry, easy decision, where the Joint Commission one we debated quite a while about.
But this is Patrick again. I would emphasize that the difference here is really a difference of two data streams and two co-stewards that are working together. ARC and the Joint Commission have been working together to harmonize this measure. Under NQF policy, we were asked to submit them as two separate measures, even though they've been harmonized, because there are some differences related to the data flow that feeds the measures. But it would be difficult, I think, to say, drop one, because then, as Anne has pointed out, then you lose a way of accessing that information. Whichever one you drop, you lose the other method of accessing that information.
So I'm confused. Why do you lose that route? It could still be reported. Let's say the Joint Commission, unless I'm misunderstanding that, let's say the Joint Commission measure is the one that goes forward. Can't the ARC measure still be used by whoever wants to use it? What am I missing here? I mean, the measure's out there.
There is a benefit to having it endorsed by NQF, and that's essentially what the decision you're making, because users will vary. Commonly, something we strongly encourage, that they will select their measures they use in their programs among the NQF endorsed measures, because it's gone through all of this angst.
Is it possible to have a joint stewardship?
Right. I just heard that word, co-stewardship.
That forces us to harmonize our measures, which we probably wouldn't do absent this process.
So I find it impossible to choose between the two. If the economic effect of both of them is the same as having either one of them, I find it impossible to choose.
I don't think you have to. As long as you have the reasoning, as long as it's not arbitrary or I like red rather than blue. I need something concrete, and you've given it.
Yeah. I mean, for me, primarily,
if
there's no additional work, economic expense for the hospitals, like whatever, like who the data flows to is pretty inconsequential to me personally.
Can I just clarify though? It might actually be cheaper, right? Because you don't need the vendor to use ARC, right? You could calculate and report it and not have to go through a third party.
Well, ARC supplies software. This is part of the patient safety indicator thing, and they provide staff programs on I don't know what other platforms for anybody to do this. So, yeah, and it's free.
The data cleaning that you have for the Joint Commission processes, that's the difference. You have self-reported data being reported. You don't have anybody looking at the quality of those data.
I mean, Reva, can you outline for us, because at this point I think some of us are confused about what we're discussing. Could we just decide what we need to discuss and decide? And
part of your discussion is making that decision.
But so what my understanding is that we have these two measures. They're very similar. We really can't substantively determine. They've already said they'll harmonize. So I guess who decides? Is it ARC or who decides who?
You do.
Okay, so we have to decide that. So maybe we should vote on that, or do we have to decide today?
I would appreciate it because, okay. I mean, is there anything that's going to change if we wait until tomorrow?
So let's do this. So here's the question. How many people want to keep all four as they are on that board and give people the choice?
Can we just do two at a time? Because there's like two different issues. Can we do the first two and then the second two?
As long as we can articulate it at the end of this, yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Should we have 478 and 1731? Should we have both 478 and 1731, recognizing that they both measure the same thing?
Yes.
Just raise your hand. Oh, we have this thing. Oh, okay. This is fun. I love this thing.
Okay, awesome.
You can vote. Hang on one quick second.
If we say yes to this one, then we are going to discuss whether to keep 478 or 1731. Is that how it is going to be next?
No. The question on the table is, do we want to keep 478 and 1731. Do we want both measures on the table? That's the question. Did you get that, Elizabeth?
Yes.
Okay.
So it seems like the commission was implying that the ARC measure would be lower quality over time. That's what I heard in the last statement. You know, that it would be self-reported and not cleaned. And I think that's an important piece of information. I mean, I think that's not an inconsequential statement personally to me.
That's the next question.
But I'm sorry. When you said cleaned, you mean that a hospital's reports will be somehow reprocessed and then it will be published something other than what they reported? Or you, by cleaned, you really just mean the kind of analysis you presented here?
What I mean is that there are 32 quality checks that our vendors put every piece of data that is submitted to them through, for missing data, for does this seem like this is an aberrant in terms of the volumes that we've seen before and the patient population. There's just a number of these things, as well as review for inter-rater reliability of the data and that kind of a thing. That is work that is done by the vendors, and then the data are reported to the Joint Commission. If the vendor finds problem with the hospital's data, they will send it back and ask them to clarify and correct. There's nothing that goes from the hospital to the Joint Commission that the hospital doesn't know about. I mean, there's not some magic box there.
Just a quick question. Patrick, can you remind me how many reports this measure to ARC? I'm sure it's in the submission.
In general, it happens through data sets that are being collected by state health data organizations or through insurance companies or others, in some cases regional collaboratives that collect this data. So overall, there are 44 states that collect data of this type from all hospitals, all non-federal hospitals within their states. So there are six states that would not currently have a reporting structure for the ARC indicator.
Which you just mean is the claims, they collect claims data and run the ARC stats back on them. The hospitals don't, they just submit their all payer data to the state, and this is part of what the states do with it?
Right. I mean, technically, we don't call it claims data because the state health data organizations are not collecting it for the purpose of processing claims. But they are generated by the hospitals with the ICD-9-CM codes, and they're submitted to the state health data organizations. Now, different state health data organizations have different mechanisms for cleaning and validating the data. So this is where our data stream is a bit different from the Joint Commission's, because the Joint Commission has certain requirements on its vendors that it requires all of its vendors to process the data in a certain way and to validate it in a certain way. Unfortunately, AHRQ doesn't have the mechanism for doing that. So we are perhaps more dependent on the different data streams that follow in different states. But that reflects the real world. As somebody said earlier, there's diversity of different data streams out there in the world. If a hospital chooses to follow the Joint Commission's data stream and to contract with one of their vendors, then that does provide some assurance about the data quality.
And if a hospital did that, can they generate the results and give it to their state if the state requires it? I mean, what we're trying to avoid is a hospital having to work to produce the result for two measures. I'm just trying to figure out, is that our job to say, well, do you know, the state of California shouldn't be requiring this because the Joint Commission is requiring it? It's the same measure. So I just don't know. I don't know whether our vote to approve one, you know, if we approve one and not the other, we're cutting off opportunities for some kinds of reporting. We just are, but why should we be, the measures are harmonized. So if you generate it for a JC, our Joint Commission, aren't you generating it for the state at the same time? Or that was the goal of harmonization, right? You wouldn't have to generate the results twice.
Right, but hospitals are not reporting the ARC measure in and of itself. It's a product of applying the software to the data that hospitals are already reporting state health data agencies. So that's why it's a different data flow. There's no additional work associated with a hospital using the ARC measure, but there's also, you lose the benefit of the Joint Commission's program for assessing and evaluating and ensuring the quality of the data as it comes into the Joint Commission, because the Joint Commission is directly collecting all of that data through its vendors.
Right, and if you eliminate the ARC measure, you would eliminate the burdenless way of reporting this measure, and you would just have the Joint Commission approach, which requires contracting with a vendor, more or less, right?
Could we move to vote on keeping the Joint Commission measure as the single measure? Could we take a vote on that? Are we ready for
the vote that's on the table is that we're going to keep both 478 and 1731, recognizing that there are advantages and disadvantages to that. So everyone can go ahead and vote. So you're voting yes if, in fact, you believe both should be available.
Can I vote?
Yeah, I vote yes.
Oh, how many people should that be? Okay. It is what it is. So we keep both. Right. 10 and 8? Okay. So then we have to vote to keep 303 and 304. Is that right? Yes. So that was the early measures. the next vote or the result of that? Oh, I'm sorry. So the result of that last vote to keep both 478 and 1731 was 10 yes, 8 no's. So now we're moving on to decide if you vote yes here, you're saying you want 303 and 304, so both bond measures, in addition to the other two. Bizarre.
But, can I ask a question? The, my understanding from previous NGS processes is that stratified versions of a measure are usually considered part of the same measure. So we have a number of ARC measures that are stratified, where those are sub-measures within a single measure. Would this fall into that classification or not?
Actually, Patrick, this is your, you know, I'm not seeing that in this particular measure, but I, and that's not the way you kind of presented it. Oh, you're talking about the bond measure. Well, that was one of the questions we asked, but they are different because the risk models are different.
Okay, well, I will say that we do have ARC measures where there are stratum-specific risk models that are still labeled under the same measure number. So it's just an issue for consistency. Not directly relevant to this panel.
If I may just say it, Joe Carpenter Vaughn again. Yes, we originally presented two measures because the populations are quite different. You know, you see an average infection rate in the very low birth weight infants around 15% versus 3%, but if it's more convenient to include these as separate populations within a single measure, I mean, that could certainly be done.
Yeah, I mean,
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we could do. It would, you know, reduce the measure clutter and the numbers, and that if that's something that appeals to you all, we can certainly work with Vaughn to do that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the cloud fees there too.
Okay. So now we're voting whether we want to keep 303 and 304. I feel differently though if you could collapse it.
Yeah, you can.
Elizabeth, did you want to vote?
Yes, I'm going to vote yes.
Okay.
Because the tough part with this, okay, I won't even say it. The vote is 13 no, 5 yes.
You haven't really changed anything. It's more, it's paper.
Okay.
So the reality hasn't changed. We could, yeah, probably, you know, put all the information under one number. The question is, there's still two measures operationally. So that's the question.
Also, you could also vote no on this, meaning no, you don't want either measure, or no, you want one measure.
Thank you.
So the majority vote is that they do not want both 303 and 304.
So now there's a measure of, do we want to keep a bond measure?
Okay.
We can.
That hasn't changed the measures by putting them into one number. That's something I can do. That's not a really huge deal. The question is, do you want two measures? Because they do have separate risk models. You're talking about two measure results.
So I think we need to ask the next question, do we want a Vaughn measure at all? Is what I'm hearing.
Am I hearing this right?
Yes. A combined Vaughn measure or a Vaughn measure at all, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do we want to combine 303 and 304? That's the question. So if you vote yes, then you want the combination 303 and 304.
Elizabeth? Elizabeth, can you still hear?
Do you really think I can remember that?
303 is the measure for all the babies.
Okay.
Okay.
And 304 is the big
babies? 304 is the very low birth weight babies.
Okay, with a higher prevalence. Okay. Well, but they told us that, and you guys told us that the very low birth weight baby is the one that is at higher risk and the prevalence is higher. That's 304. Okay. Yes, 303, which is the whole population.
Yeah,
it's just a yes-no ability at this point.
So it's 3 yes and 14 no. I think you should take the vote on 304 just to be sure that it's clear.
Okay. So now we're voting on 304, which is the smallest baby's highest prevalence. Can everybody press their button one more time, because we're missing one. Wow. That's weird. Or whatever.
I think, you know, we could keep repeating and doing this. The next steps, I think, are important. You guys have made decisions and recommendations on all of the measures that we can capture and, in fact, are in the process of capturing. And essentially our next step is to bundle it all up and post it for public comment. You're going to get a chance to see what that comment is, feedback is. And at that point, you may need to, you know, rethink some of the issues based on the feedback you get. It'll be an opportunity to take one more look at it. And the fact that some of these are close, yeah, these are tough. These are not easy issues. And that's kind of the reality of the world we're working in. So what we'd like to do, as everybody is leaving, just a couple of follow-up things. We'll have a summary out to you shortly, probably early next week, for you to take a look at. One area we didn't get to on the agenda, and although it came up a couple of times, if your thoughts about the kinds of measures that aren't currently in the portfolio, the gaps, the kinds of things you would like to see developed, shoot me an email. You know, send us in. We'll include them because it's a nice paragraph to provide guidance to the world about the kinds of things that, you know, we looked at these and it's okay, but gee, we wish we had measures of this, this, and this, and, you know, as well. So that's an important thing.
And should it send to you only or to everybody? Even
to everybody, yeah. I mean, just it won't go anywhere in N2F if you don't include me. So you can talk about yourselves all you want to, but if you want us to put it in the report, it's got to come to me. I think that's really all the business we had. Thank you all for you know, hanging in. We need to do public comment.
May I just ask what the vote was on 304?
It was yes 9, no 8.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So, is there anybody on the phone, or nobody's still in the room, who wanted to say anything? Is there somebody, it's behind the pillar, I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm Tina Johnson from the American College of Nurse Midwives, and I want to thank you all for all of your hard work, and I just wanted to call to your attention a landmark, unprecedented document that was just released today that just came across our emails that involves the American Academy of Family Physicians, AAP, Pediatrics, ACNM, ACOG, A1, SMFM, and the osteopath, OBGYNs. And that document is entitled Leading Healthcare Organizations Issue Recommendations for Quality Patient Care and Labor and Delivery. An Unprecedented Collaboration Creates a Joint Call to Action. And basically, I will step forward this to anybody that wants, but it's going to be on all our organizational websites. We recommend for healthcare providers and administrators that we ensure patient-centered care and safety that are organizational priorities guiding decisions for policies, fostering a culture of openness by promoting active communication of good outcomes and opportunities for improvement, developing forums to facilitate communication and track issues of concern, providing resources for clinicians, and this is the one I think that is key and most relevant here, providing resources for clinicians to be trained in the principles of teamwork, safety, and shared decision-making, develop methods to systematically track and evaluate care processes and outcomes, facilitate cross-departmental sharing of resources and expertise, ensure that quality obstetric care is a priority that guides individual and team decisions, identify and communicate safety concerns, and work together to mitigate safety risks, to disseminate and use the best available evidence, including individual and hospital-level data to guide practice patterns. And so as we're all discussing this today, this is coming out. I think that one of the major gaps we have here is a way to really track the processes that are going on. And I think that maybe moving forward, if you think about this in terms of systems and in terms of teamwork, communication, and those practices that we know produce good outcomes, moving forward, I think that there are major quality gaps in that arena that these documents address. So thank you for listening.
Look forward to seeing the document. Yeah. Anybody else? Anybody on the phone? Tracy, is there anybody on the line, person?
Okay.
I can open the lines now.
Okay, please go.
And I'll interrupt it.
Any comments or questions from anybody on the phone?
Yeah, just I might have missed it. Did you talk about research recommendations for the future for measure developers?
We just did. We haven't had there wasn't time for the conversation, but during the course of conversation, things have picked up, and I've asked everyone to send me their thoughts and ideas.
Can you say when you need them?
Within the next week.
One quick announcement, everybody. Before you leave, can you leave your flash drives and your magic remotes for voting? We have to recycle the good old flash drives for our other committees. But all the documents that were on there are either on SharePoint or on our website. Thank you.